Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisian, Woody Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the triumphant 13th episode of Who's Who Review, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and along with me, as always, is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
I have to say, Shag, considering that our last episode had Chuck Patton as a guest, recording back again with you is kind of a disappointment. but let me say, I'm sure you're feeling the exact same way.
Right. I mean, that's sort of an evergreen statement, right? Anytime we're going to record together, it's like, oh, that guy.
All right. Okay. Yeah, we had Chuck Patton last time.
Only been doing this for 15 years. Okay, whatever. Speaking of which, folks, for those of you at home, yeah, Rob and I are celebrating, in quotes, celebrating, 15 years of podcasting together. We started podcasting together in the sort of end of August, beginning of September, all the way back in 2011. And this is it, 15 years.
Unbelievable. Oh,
which means we've been doing Who's Who for 14 and a half.
Oh, my God. Oh, my.
So, Rob, why don't you remind people why we do this show?
Well, okay. We love the Who's Who original series, all of them, but especially the original series, plus this show. And we're always looking to find ways to continue this podcast. And this show, Who's Who Review, gives us a chance to talk about our favorite volume of Who's Who in a hopefully fresh new way.
And we've randomized the entries is what we've done. We've categorized, I should say, indexed. That's the word I'm trying to find. Every single entry of the original Who's Who, which is 819 entries, by the way. Mm. And we use a randomizer. And what does that sound like?
Boop, 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 boop.
Boy, that was a little peppy. And we use that to randomize a selection of 13 entries to cover every single episode and plus a Zoom Who entry. So we are going to dive into this in a fun way in just a few minutes here. But first, we need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Who's Who is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. So what you got, buddy?
Well, as always, it's based off one of the entries. In this case, Doibie Dickel, so I'm talking about DC Finest Plastic Man, the origin of Plastic Man trade paperback. These are the original Plastic Man stories by the one and only Jack Cole, reprinting Police Comics 1 through 36 and Plastic Man 1 and 2. 584 pages, normal price $39.99, in stock trades price $23.99, you save 42%. I mean, everyone's loving these DC Finest volumes. Like, they're just, these are like printing money here because they're so popular. And I love that DC's printing kind of some more obscure stuff, right? It's not just Superman, Batman, you know, whatever. It's Plastic Man and the horror comics and stuff like that. So this is great. DC Finest, Plastic Man.
That's awesome. And what a great collection. What a great character who has absolutely nothing to do with Doibie Dickel. That's really great because you're thinking of Woozy Winks.
Oh, that's right. I am. Oh, my God. I'm so old now. You're right. Doibie Dickel is Green Lantern. Oh, holy, wow. That was embarrassing.
Yes, it was for one of us, and I'm glad it's on tape. Did you even read his entry?
I did, but I forgot. I just blanked. It's funny because then I went to In Stock Trades today because I'm like, oh, I got an In Stock Trades ad. And I just, my head just went, Doibie Dickel, Plastic Man. Oh, that's right. That's Woozy Went. Wow, that was embarrassing. All right, well, we're leaving this in.
If it makes you feel any better, I recently did an episode of JSA in the 90s with Doug Zawisha, and we were trying to brainstorm supporting cast members who don't have powers, and we actually couldn't come up with Woozy Wink's name either. So if it makes you feel any better, you're not the only one. I just didn't do it on the air.
Again, it's not – right. Well, there you go. I mean, look, I've embarrassed myself on air before. This won't be the – it's not the first time, won't be the last. Again, in my defense, it was not – that I read the listing and then went right to In Stock Trades. It was literally, we were looking through the notes and I was like, oh, we did the highlighting. You know how we do the nuts and bolts of the show, everybody. And then I was in the middle of working and I went, oh, I didn't do In Stock Trades. Let me, and my brain just went Doivy Dickles Plastic Man. Just made that connection, even though that's not accurate. So sorry about that, everybody. But nevertheless, hey, I still recommended a good book.
Yes,
DC Finest Plastic Man. It's not like I picked something terrible.
I love that you made it worse by just over-explaining it. Anyway.
Yeah, well, now I'm feeling very defensive, and I'm going to go on and on about it.
So my pick does actually have something to do with one of the entries, and I'm not going to tell you who. You guys will find out in a minute. It is Teen Titans by Geoff Johns, Trade Paperback Compendium, Volume 1, because it needed that long of a title. It's the Teen Titans, guys, by Geoff Johns. And this thing is 1,326 pages. Now, normally when we talk about a book this big, it's going to cost like $125. Not this one, because this one's paperback. And so I'll just say the price up front, then I'll tell you what's in it. You're only going to pay $36 basically is what you're paying. 40% off, you're only paying $36 for 1,326 pages of incredible comics. This is the Geoff Johns era of the Teen Titans. So you've got basically issues 1 through 28. You've got the Young Justice crossover. You've got the Outsider Secret Files, the Legion crossover, the Beast Boy miniseries, some Outsider stuff, Return of Donald Troy. Okay, not all of them can be winners. Some Supergirl stuff. Anyway, there's a lot in here, full color. Again, 1,336 pages, primarily written by Geoff Johns, but some of the crossover stories, you know, written by Judd Winnick or Gail Simone. Art's primarily going to be Mike McCone, plus some Tom Grumman, some other people in there. Cover art's by Michael Turner. This thing is a great era of Teen Titans. I mean, this really reinvigorated my love for the Titans. So great collection. And one of the big bads in that storyline is somebody we're going to cover in just a second. So there we go. So for this and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our website, our Patreon. And what's that address, Rob?
Patreon.com/FWPodcast.
And while you're there, you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network. In a certain tier, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be specifically recognized on the Who's Who podcast. Our thanks go out to Al the Comics Guy, Chuck Coletta, Mike Atchison, Damian Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Gord Tolton,
Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Corey Balanecki, Noah Tarnell, Phil Becker, Steve Givens, and Tom Panarese.
Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast. Now, folks, we are going to post these 13 entries on our website, Fire and Water Podcast. Go there for the gallery post. Leave your comments on the website because that is where we pull your feedback for the back half of the show. Now, Rob, I'm excited here because the randomizer has done us a pretty solid. I mean, this is a pretty good group of characters. There's even some pretty major headliners in here. But here, why don't we tell them, tease them with some of the artists involved.
George Perez.
Keith Giffen.
Carmine Infantino.
Tom Mandrake.
Ross Andrew.
Matt freaking Wagner.
Sean McManus.
Steve Lytle.
Kurt friggin' Swan.
Ron Friendly Randall.
Joe took a lot of my money, Kubert.
And many more, folks. All right. Well, let's get into this, folks. So the very first entry, you run up the randomizer and it goes boop, 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 boop. And who do you get, Rob?
Brother Blood, one of the big New Teen Titans villains. He first appeared in New Teen Titans number 21, of course, drawn by George Perez. Him of one of the great helmets, I would say, of all time. This big skull thing that's got a mask on underneath. It's, you know, we've talked about this, all the George Perez costumes. Over-designed, right?
Yeah,
too many accessories. You know, Coco Chanel would say, you're over-accessorizing, Brother Blood. But yet, these George Perez costumes exist in the George Perez visual universe, and therefore they make sense.
Yes.
So he is basically the high priest of this sort of subterranean religious quasi-cult, blood cult sort of thing. He's the high priest of the Church of Blood and stuff like that. And so he has come back to thwart the New Teen Titans many times. Powers and weapons, all of basically his main power is he recruits new members to his pyramid scheme. That's basically his power. Because you see, his powers and weapons is like two sentences. That's about it. He doesn't really have any powers, so to speak.
Well, he does bathe in the blood of his enemies, which
he sure does.
You know, I guess makes him feel energetic or whatever. But so for me, like I'm going to actually ask you some questions because I'm not terribly familiar with this character. By the way, he's the villain from those Teen Titans issues I read. Like I'm more familiar with him from like the Geoff Johns era rather than he was in the Perez era. Because for me, I only read probably the first year of the original Perez Wolfman Teen Titans. So I never got to Brother Blood. Okay. So like, what was it like? Like, I mean, was this, did this villain leave a big impression on you as a reader?
I thought it was cool. I'm a big, like when it comes to horror movies and stuff, like I'm a big cult horror movie guy. Like I like movies about cults or about groups of people kind of operating on the margins. Like I kind of find that fascinating and stuff like that. And that's one of the, because the idea of the brother blood thing started, his origin starts in 1102. And they talk about that. It's basically this line of succession that where they're like killing each other to take control of the church of blood. And it talks about right at the very end, it says, using his power, the Church of the Brother Blood has grown from a small Zandian cult to a worldwide religion. Followers of Brother Blood are high-ranking officials in almost every nation, and they await their master's commands. So that all that stuff was super creepy. I remember thinking it was like, kind of like, you know, like, oh, this is real horror element in this new Teen Titans comic with Beast Boy and Starfire and stuff like that. So I always dug this. I always thought he looks cool. I always thought they were, you know, he was like a neat character. And again, the whole idea of the bathing in the blood, the whole Elizabeth Bathory thing sort of taken from real life and things like that. So I always dug this character. And of course, as drawn by and inked by George Perez, it looks amazing.
But I think this also is the beginning of George's love affair with white capes, because he really went through a white cape phase, Raven's going to wear all white and things like that, too. So I kind of fell down a rabbit hole looking stuff up out here. Like you said about the generational succession thing, they kind of said that basically someone takes over around age 20. They murder their father. And it looks like they each rule for about 80 years or so. So there looks like there's been about 10 Brother Bloods. And I thought it was reading this entry. I thought it was pretty bold to sort of entangle your supervillain's origin with, quote, the cloak of Christ to use these Christian artifacts. That's pretty ballsy of Wolfman there to pull it off, obviously. So I guess I was asking primarily because, like, for me, even though I like him in those later Teen Titan stories, he always kind of felt like the Pepsi version of Coca-Cola's Cobra to me. Like, you know, I felt like they were kind of the same cloth, if you will.
I never really quite made that connection. I mean, I guess, yeah, there's similarities in that it's like this cult thing, but I don't know. I always found Brother Blood to be more sinister. I like the idea that like he's got them seated in various government seats across the world. Cobra didn't really do that exactly. So, I'm a big sucker for the cults and the whole like the activating everybody. I mean, it's actually kind of Hail Hydra. When you think about it, it's more that kind of thing. But that's over, of course. That's across the street at Marvel. But yeah, I mean, I can't say like I stopped reading New Teen Titans. I read all of New Teen Titans as a regular series, and then I bought the Baxter book, and then I'm sure I bailed on it when Perez left. Yeah, so I can't say most people did. I can't say I remember a whole lot of other stories other than the initial ones of Brother Blood. But I don't know. It just felt like, oh, this is kind of darker than what I expect from the new Teen Titans. I always liked him. Again, and he looks really cool.
Yeah, and I'm not necessarily knocking him. Again, I've read a lot of great stories with him in later runs of the Teen Titans. So now it's interesting. At this point, he had only been around for 3 years. So because he first premieres in 1982, so only 3 years later, and he's already making this kind of impact. You know, and this is like to me, I thought he was a big deal at this point, and he'd only been around for 3 years. The logo's kind of cool. The blood is dripping and looks all, you know, kind of scratchy the way it's written. And if you want more on him, of course, you could listen to the Titan Up the Defense podcast. You can look at the Pop Culture Affidavit. He's been in various Teen Titans cartoons. He's been in Arrow, the Titans, various video games and direct-to-DVD movies. Lots of opportunities to catch up with this character. So, all right. Ready to move on?
Yeah.
All right. Next is a half-page entry. This is from issue number 5, and it's Cosmic King. Not to be confused. What's going on?
Biggest
there?
Loser page in the history. I'm sorry.
You're going to make Dr. Ange cry because it's the Cosmic King from his beloved Legion, and then the Council from his beloved Supergirl.
Oh so, boy.
Remember how we used to wring our hands over the Council and the Gang? Oh my gosh. Anyway,
DC was known to say, "Can we do quarter page listings. Is that possible?
So this is Cosmic King, as drawn by Tom Mandrake, I believe, former Joe Kubert student, also, isn't that right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
All my alma mater, absolutely.
So you've got Cosmic King, who looks essentially like a grown-up cosmic boy, is what he's supposed to look like. But he looks like he's more evil, because his face is more rugged-looking, and you got him in the surprint, and he looks all surly and angry. And you see him using his powers to transmute a tree, this giant maybe oak tree, and changing the top half into crystal. So, and then the logo, I believe that is a variant of the Cosmic Boy logo, actually. I can't promise that because it's not exactly one for one, but to my eye, it looks like a variant of the Cosmic Boy logo. So, pretty cool. Now, right out of the gate, first appearance is Legion of Superheroes number 2. That is just flat out wrong. I did some research on this. Turns out it's actually Superman 147 from 1961. And Cosmic King was part of the Legion of Supervillains, the first era of Legion. Like, we know Legion of Supervillains as like this giant two-page spread in Who's Who with like 20 characters and all this stuff. But the original Legion of Supervillains was just three characters, and they were all adults. It was the Cosmic King, it was Saturn Queen, and Lightning Lord. They were just the equivalents of the original three Legionnaires. And in those original stories back in the 60s, they didn't even fight the Legion. They fought the adult Superman. So it was, you know, adult Superman versus adult Legion of Supervillains. It sort of made sense. And in fact, their first appearance was this play on that famous cover, first cover with the Legion. Now, all credit, I did not get all this from the entry. I had to do some research, and the most useful resource I found, believe it or not, on the entire internet for this character was something called Siskoid's Blog of Geekery. So credit to our own network co-founder, Siskoid, for his help in helping to explain this to me. Because by the time we get the big Legion of Supervillains, the one that we know from Who's Who, where, again, it's like that two-page spread with tons of characters, whatever, Cosmic King is really a minor member of that group. So really his heyday was fighting Superman, not Superboy. So his story is he's from Venus, and he accidentally gained transmutation powers. And then he is exiled in disgrace from Venus because of this, because the natives felt transmutation was inherently evil. So, wow, so much for judging people on their own merits, apparently on Venus. So he gets kicked out of Venus and goes to a life of crime. So that's where you get Cosmic King. So what do you think of that? I've been talking nonstop. I didn't give you a chance to talk. What do you think of Tom Mandrake's art here?
I mean, Tom Mandrake's a great artist. I wonder how he landed on this. He has no connection to Legion, as far as I know, at all.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought he drew Legion. I thought he drew Legion for a while. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay.
Did he? I didn't think so. I'm familiar with him for Batman and stuff. I didn't. Maybe he did. I did not think so. I mean, you know, I'm sure. Again, my whole thing about the Legion has been well stated. We don't need to go over it again. I'm sure I just went over this. I was like, yeah, whatever. Fine, Cosmic King. I don't matter. All right, that's fine. You know, so, I mean, you know, there's not much there, but it's funny, like, you don't, you know, as you mentioned, like, the scowl, like,
yeah.
I'm sure I knew who Cosmic Boy was, so I'm sure when I got to this listing, if I even bothered to read it, probably not, I probably was like, I don't even know who that is, but I know it's, oh, that must be an evil version, because just look at him, he's all scowly.
Yep, you
know?
Exactly, exactly. Okay. Well, for more information, you can look on the Legion of Super Bloggers or, again, check out Siskoid's Blog of Geekery. So, all right. Up next, oh my gosh. Oh my all gosh. Right.
Can I tell you that when
no,
the when the randomizer picked this, I said there is zero chance I am getting this one. There is zero chance I am getting this one.
I'll let you talk eventually, but.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
The character is Dr. Midnight. Oh my gosh. Dr. Charles McKnighter, folks, from issue number 6 of Who's Who. And the art is by Matt freaking Wagner and Romeo Tangal. So, wow. Okay. So, the logo is probably like an original logo because it's kind of, you know, big bubbly letter, whatever. But so the art is in the foreground. You've got Dr. Midnight. He's got his cape surrounding him. His right arm is raised as if he's waiting for Owly or Hootie or whatever the owl's name is to land on his arm. And the blackness of the cape on the inside is just enveloping, making this huge darkness. He looks very serious, and he's got 1 foot forward, like he's just barely stepping towards you. It's imposing. It's gorgeous, because, again, it's Matt Wagner and Romeo Tangal. Then in the surprint, there's this blue surprint You've got sort of Dr. Charles McKnighter's face wearing the sunglasses. Looks very Matt Murdock, really, in black and white or single color. Then you've got a giant moon shape. You've got him, a beautiful silhouette. All you can see is the silhouette of Dr. Midnight as he's throwing his blackout pellets, but you can just make out the lenses of his goggles and the moon on his mask, which is amazing. Never would be able to tell this if we didn't have the digital versions of this art, by the way. In the original comic, that would be lost, but the digital versions nowadays, you can see that. Anyway, he's throwing the blackout bomb. And there's a couple of hoods that are like sort of ducking from the black smoke. And then you have on the bottom right-hand corner, you've got him at a typewriter writing, because at this point in his career, I guess he's a magazine writer, which we're going to talk about. And you even see his cane there in silhouette. And the owl's flying in. The owl, oh my gosh, the owl's flying in, and he's lit from below. So the top half of the owl is completely in black, but the bottom half is lit. You can see the light lines, I guess is the best way to describe it. The whole piece is freaking gorgeous. So, what do you think of this, buddy?
It is one of the top 10 listings of the entire Who's Who.
Yes.
I mean, maybe that's a show we should do someday. We probably talked about
Oh,
that, right?
we have talked
Just
about it, but it's just
doing
so
our
hard.
top 10. But this has got to be up there because Dr. Midnight's costume is goofy. It's a goofy costume. It's got way too many colors. It's got way too many things. But when it is drawn by someone of the skill of Matt Wagner, and in this case, inker Romeo Tengel, it looks absolutely amazing, as it did in that John K. Snyder miniseries, which you talked with Matt Wagner and John K. Snyder about. It's just you're like, you, this is like the kind of thing where you're like, you see it, and if you don't know this character, you're like, oh, this guy must be like second only to Batman because he's so incredibly cool. Like, this is just he's Batman and Daredevil smooshed
Yes.
together. And you're like, who doesn't want to read that? You're like, oh, is this what his this guy's series look like? This must have run 10,000 issues. This is the coolest thing ever. You know, it's yeah, clearly top 10 listing, period.
Well, you've mentioned, I was going to mention the end, but you've already brought it up. So, yes, Matt Wagner, who I guess I can call an acquaintance now, because I interviewed Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III on the JSA in the 90s podcast to talk all about the Pieter Cross version of Dr. Midnight. So, you can check that out as part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed. And he told us there he'd had a love of Dr. Midnight for years. So, when he did that series, it wasn't like it came out of the blue. It's something they had been talking about doing forever. So if he drew this in 1985, he was probably already thinking about a Dr. Midnight miniseries. So the history here is he was a physician, right? And he was asked by the police to treat a mob informant who had been hurt. Well, the mob found out, so they threw a hand grenade in the room, and that explosion blinded Charles McKnighter. And he found out that he could only see in the dark. So he could see it perfectly in the dark, but during the daytime he could not. So he ends up like fashioning special glasses so that he can still get by in the daytime. But he becomes, you know, a creature of the night, if you will, as you said, sort of a Batman almost. Now the thing that kind of gave me pause, I was reading this. It says here he's a former physician because he gave up his physician career when he went blind and he became a magazine writer. Which is strange to me because, I mean, I'm not shocked that he's a writer at some point, but the way this Who's Who entry implies is that he's been a writer since he first got the powers, which is very strange to me because I've always known him as a physician. Like every comic, he's, you know, Dr. Charles McKnighter helping people. So I don't know at what point he gave up being a physician completely. I maybe someone at home can fill in some blanks here for me because that threw me.
By the way, I'm sorry, just you mentioned the logo.
Yeah.
That as actually is his logo from the 40s.
Yeah, I figured as much. It looked like it. Yeah. Just it's very big block letters. It looks nice though. It looks kind of
Yeah. Oh no,
stylistic.
it's beautiful. Yeah.
Yep. So, first appearance is All American Comics number 25 from 1941. And if you want more on this character, of course, like I said, you know, my interview on Justice Society Presents with Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III. You can listen to the Earth 2 podcast. You can go to the new Earth 2 website. You can listen to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast. You can even listen to the Secret Origins podcast, which I'm pretty sure I did the Dr. Midnight entry on as well with Ryan. He's had appearances on Smallville, Legends of Tomorrow, Stargirl.
He was on Smallville.
They had a
I
two-parter like called Absolute Justice or something like that
don't know
with the
why I'm
JSA.
surprised at any of
Yep.
this anymore, but okay.
Legends of Tomorrow, they traveled back to the 40s. Then on Stargirl, he was a regular supporting character because the young girl, Beth Chappell, becomes Dr. Midnight, but her goggles has Charles McKnighter's like consciousness in it, so he talks to her the whole time on Stargirl, which is great. He's made appearances on Batman Brave and the Bold, Young Justice. He had some non-speaking roles on Justice League Unlimited, various directed DVDs. I mean, he's really gotten a lot of life, which is great because he is such a great character. And he's not a household name, but certainly he's a character that a lot of people I think recognize now.
And yeah, again, we're going. First of all, I'm surprised you actually showed restraint. I really figured you'd be going on and on about this, considering. But also, I just want to talk about the artwork a little bit more.
Sure,
like
please do.
The darks and lights of this, in terms of the silhouette of Dr. Midnight in the background throwing the bomb, and then the inset of him at the bottom where he's typing, and it's all in silhouette, and then like in his the civilian shot, like I love that his shirt is black and the blazer he's wearing is white. Mm-hmm. Like it's just such a perfect understanding of how darks and lights work. I mean, of course, it's Matt Wagner. That's not a surprise, but just this is really, you know, when I was, I mean, I knew who Dr. Midnight was long before I got Who's Who because I've been, I read all the JSA comics stuff. But man, I remember getting to this. I'm like, oh my God. Like, this is like, this is amazing. Like, oh my God. Like, I can't, I mean, you didn't ask Matt Wagner about it. I mean, I feel like you should call him up. I want to ask him about this. Be like, when you finish this, right? I mean, it was, I mean, I really, Romeo Tango linked it. But when you finish this, did you just like sit back in your chair and go, man, I'm good. You know, like this is so, so beautiful. And it's not even an action pose. We're always kind of complaining, right? That it's like, oh, the characters are just standing there. But he's just posing. But nevertheless, it looks so boss. It's unbelievable.
Well, first off, you suggested me reaching out to Matt Wagner and asking. I'm not going to abuse my power there. But we used to say this every once in a while, this phrase, and it really applies here. This could work as your pitch piece for a Dr. Midnight animated series.
Oh, completely.
Like yeah. Completely. I mean, we used to say that a lot about certain entries, and it definitely is for this one. I mean, it tells you the whole story, right? He's clearly blind in there, yet he's an action guy. He's got that creepy vibe to him. Like you said, the way they use the darks, you know you're going to film a lot of shadow. Like, feels very 1990s, filmed in Vancouver, pretending to be New York, kind of, you know, straight to syndication series vibe.
Top 10.
Excellent entry. All right, well, now we move on. Rob, you want to tell us a little bit about the very first two-page spread in Who's Who?
Yes, this is the Flash of Earth 1, Flash 2, I guess is really what it's called. We don't need to really get into the details of the Flash. Everyone knows who this is. I can. It's funny, you know, things have come and gone. 40 years of hence, there are people I've dated whose names I don't remember. But I remember getting this issue and opening it and being like, oh, I didn't know that they could do two-page. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't occur to me that they could really do it. Now, they had to have done two-page spreads before for teams, right, to this point? There had to have been a team that got two.
Also, didn't All-Star Squadron get two pages?
No, they got one. Because now they only got... No, oh my God, why do we not remember these things? Anyway.
It's embarrassing considering we've been doing the show for so long. But this is from issue number 8 of Who's Who, by the way. So if you were to go through the previous 7 issues, which I'm sure someone is doing right now to prove us wrong, maybe you would find a team or something like Atari Force maybe had two.
I know they didn't. But anyway, this is the first single character to get two pages. Because I remember Batman getting a single page. And it was like, really? A single page for Batman? And then obviously, during the development of the series, they realized, you know what? Some characters have just got to, we can't do one page for the Flash. He is the linchpin of what was that point still the modern DCU, right? Because they
he's the first character of the Silver Age.
Yeah, I mean, first character of the Silver Age. And he met, you know, they brought in the Justice Society again through the Flash comic. Like, it was everything. So he just carries with him an enormous amount of history. It's drawn by Carmen Infantino and Murphy Anderson. It's pretty good. I mean, there's something about him running towards the camera that looks strange, but I also realize I wouldn't want a profile shot of him either. You want him running right towards the camera. Mm-hmm. And we see him with his, you know, unpacking his ring. We see the origin where he's getting hit by the lightning. We see him without his mask. We see him with his wife. And then we see his collection of Rogues Gallery. Now, this is before he dies in Crisis, so it doesn't mention anything about that. And in fact, this listing leaves him in a happy place. It talks about that he's been exonerated for the murder trial and has gone to live in the 30th century with Iris. So you're like, oh, that's nice, you know, but it's all going to go to crap not too long after this, but at this point.
Well, to be specific, did you hear what issue I said this is from Who's Who?
Eighth.
Okay, and do you remember what was had a corresponding publication?
Oh, it was Crisis 8 the same month?
Yeah, it's
Oh,
2 weeks later,
jeez.
man. So this
Oh.
comes out, yeah, and little Rob Kelly reads this, and then
Oh,
2 weeks later, little
no.
Rob Kelly's bawling his eyes out
I
because Flash is dead.
don't think
I have a story about that when you're done, though. Go
I don't
ahead.
think I cried. But anyway, it's a great list. I mean, it's a great listing. Look, it has a lot of history, but he's the Flash. I mean, you can't really skimp on this. So even though, and I think it avoids the this happened then that happened that much,
Yes,
for how
it
much it
does.
is, it's a little better written than that. So, it's fitting considering what a linchpin to the universe he was.
Yeah, no, it's good. And I'm going to mention something we mentioned last time. I know for a fact we talked about this, whatever, 12 years ago. They actually take the time in this entry to point out the whole thing about Mopey. How they're so pedantic. They go into the like the story of Mopey creating the Flash is a lie or whatever. It's like, wow, somebody really felt strongly enough to put that in the entry. Okay. I do have a question about the Serpent. So I'm obviously Carmine has a long history of the Flash, and obviously he was drawing the Flash at the end, so he is the right guy to draw
Yes.
it. But on the left-hand side, there's the shot of the ring and the costumes coming out of it. What is going on with Barry's collar in that picture? Is he wearing a tuxedo?
He looks like he's wearing like a Victorian overcoat,
Right.
you
It's like
know? Yeah.
or a trench coat, or is that just a 70s hang glider
Yeah,
collar? I
it
just
is
didn't
very,
know.
very, yeah, he is not fashion forward at that point.
Now, you mentioned the firsts, right? Now, you're right. The very first person, first hero of the Silver Age. He's the first one to reconnect with Golden Age heroes. What was he the first one also to get married, or did Aquaman and Mera beat him
I
to the punch?
think Aquaman predates him in terms of literally getting married.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Some weird things in here. You talked about him going to the 30th century. So, I mean, only in Bronze Age comics does this make any kind of sense. Is you find out Iris was born not in the 20th century where she lived, but in the 30th century. And she was sent back in time as an infant and never knew she's from the future. Then, oh no, this gets worse. Then Reverse Flash kills her, right? But her parents, who are in the 30th century, they perform a psychic transplant, as you do, and transplanted her spirit all the way to the 30th century to inhabit the body of some other dead woman. Then it gets better. The spirit comes back to the 20th century during the trial of the Flash, and she tries to rig the jury so Barry would get an innocent conviction. How's that for being a hero?
That's so legal.
Right. Then, anyway, as you said, by the end, they're happily living in the 30th century, but he's living with this new Iris whose spirit is in the body of some other dead woman. So,
So creepy.
so icky. So icky. All right. So, I briefly will tell you my origin. I related all this on an episode of the Monitor Tapes with our buddies DC Dave and Doug. But so, for me, it's 1985, right? And I picked up Flash number 350. The final issue of The Flash from the local convenience store. And I had my eye on it for a while, right? But for whatever, it was like $1.25. It was probably out of my price range or something. And it was pretty dog-eared. It had been sitting there. It's just like the well shelf-worn copy, right? So, but and I was familiar with the Barry Allen Flash because I'd already bought a bunch of back issues of The Flash that featured Firestorm, right? So I buy 350 and I read it. And I probably couldn't make head or tail of it, I'm sure, because it's confusing as hell with all the 30th century nonsense. But apparently I loved it. I really enjoyed it. And I decided at that moment, reading issue 350, that Barry Allen was now my guy. He that me and Barry, we are going places together as a fan and a hero. So I knew that I was going to start buying any new comic with Barry Allen. That's again in 1985, if you know where this story is going, folks. Then I buy the DC Heroes role playing game. And that's there's a bigger story there. But anyway, there's this index of all the characters, and it tells you like all their statistics and gives you a little history. So I came across Barry Allen the Flash. I'm excited. Again, here's my guy, right? So I'm reading the stats and powers, and I'll get to the section of the biography, and the last line in the role playing bi book bio says Barry Allen died as a result of the crisis on Infinite Earths. And you know that, like, you'd love to talk about that famous dolly shot in Jaws, right? Where Roy Scheider's like his face goes back and the goes forward and the
Yeah,
background goes blah,
they
yeah.
they zoom out and push in at the same time,
Yeah,
which gives it
creates that
that
weird
weird
vertigo
thing.
effect. That happened to me when I read that Barry Allen was dead. And I'm like, what? My guy just died? And I'm reading it about it in a role-playing book? So, of course, I as quickly as possible, I got to the store and bought my first issue of Crisis, which was Crisis number 8. So, the death of the Flash, all because of that. So, in the same week, I started collecting Crisis on Infinite Earths and Who's Who at the same time. So, well, anyway, that's my story.
Now I'm going to start watching this show, Misfits of Science. This will be on forever.
Same year.
Shag Matthews, age 12.
The trauma of being a 12-year-old boy, 13-year-old boy. So first appearance showcase number 4 from 1956. Normally I do like you can find this character other places. It is the freaking Flash, okay? Obviously the Flash TV show went for, I don't know, 24 years, something, I don't know. But his TV credits go back as far as the Superman Aquaman Hour of Adventure with those Justice League shorts. And obviously, he's done a million other things. The only thing I will mention is just like the actors are best known for playing. I mean, Wesley Shipp, great man, wonderful man, great character actor. Grant Gustin did an amazing job in the show. And unfortunately, we ended with Ezra Miller. So hopefully, we'll get another version of The Flash in live action soon. Hopefully. So, all
Good
right,
stuff.
Rob, up next. How exciting. Why don't you
All
tell
right.
us about this one?
One of my favorites from the Omega Men, Harpus, or Harpies. I guess, I mean, Harpies sounds plural, so I've always called her Harpus, even though I've probably never heard the name actually said out loud. One of the members of the Omega Men. She first appeared in Green Lantern number 141, so she's one of the original ones. She is the sort of slightly demonic looking creature. I mean, not really demonic, but I mean, by our sort of standards, but she's got these wings and
Hold on.
claws.
Her sister is named Demonia. So, I
Yeah,
mean, yeah, demonic's
yes.
not that far off.
Her sister is Demony, who is evil. Harpus is nice. Harpus is one of the good Omega Men. This is drawn by Sean McManus and Bob Smith, who was drawing Omega Men at the time. It's very funny to me how just artistic styles can change, because the big thing everyone remembers from Harpus is that she gets attacked by this bounty hunter named Bedlam, who literally rips her wings out of her back.
Ugh.
And when that was done in Omega Men, that was not drawn by Sean McManus. That was before, I forget who the artist was before him, who McManus took over from. That sequence is really brutal. Like, they do the rip, and the whole, even though you don't really see it, it's really startling. But here you see it in the serp print, and it looks bad, but because McManus has such a cartoony style, it just looks more goofy.
Oh,
Or kind of
geez,
like,
really?
kind of not goofy, but it does. It just looks like, oh, okay, that looks kind of. But in the comic, it was like, can they print this? This is awful. This is terrible. Now they get into the fact that she did get healed up. She got brought back to her home planet and got healed up, and she rejoined the Omega Men and became Tigor's sort of girlfriend. But boy, that oh God, that comic. I love the Omega Men. I know everyone rides on them, but I've always loved the Omega. I read every issue of the Omega Men as a kid. I don't know.
So the Sean McManus artwork here is absolutely stunning. You've got the close-up of her sort of demonic face. You've got, as you said, the wing ripping off, which I know you have the other scene to compare it to. So to me, I don't know that other scene. So this looks pretty horrific to me. Just the shredding of the wings and her horror and screaming. You see a full body shot of her in her little, I guess sort of furry bathing suit or whatever. And then in the background, there is a shot of her when she was absolutely beautiful. That's one thing I didn't realize till I read this entry. She used to be gorgeous. She
Yeah,
was
they've been
beautiful.
they would yeah, they've been transformed.
Yeah, they were transformed by the Citadel and Blackfire. So, and at one point, she even gets sent to a bordello. So I mean, this gets pretty mature pretty quick there. So a lot of history there. And I did dig her height. So she's 5'6", not counting the wings. I like that they took the time to mention that. Her logo is very pretty, by the way. Someone really took the time to design the heck out of this logo. All the bottom parts of the letter are pointy and lively and moving, and then the H has a giant wing coming across the top. It's a really nice logo.
It is. I think all the Omega Men got like their own logos, their own custom logos, which is kind of amazing that they put the effort into it. But yeah, it's quite nice.
So this is from issue 10 of Who's Who, by the way. And her first appearance, as you said, is Green Lantern 141, which I had to look up. So the Omega Men went from their very first appearance in Green Lantern to having their own series in just 2 years. So either they made a real impression on someone, or they just the creative people behind it really pushed and said, we've got something here. As I said with Flash, normally this is the part where I mention all the places you can find the character. And like the Flash, there's so many places to find Harpus that I'm just not going to bother rattling them all off because that could just take a long time.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Speaking of characters in other media, up next is Karate Kid, who, yes, did get credited in the Ralph Macchio film in the credits. They had to credit DC Comic owning the term Karate Kid. So here, the art is by Steve Lytle and Larry Malstead. The logo is from the original comic, the Karate Kid logo, which looks so boss. Anyway, in the foreground, you've got him in his really cool white gi with black pants and the yellow highlights, and he's looking like he's getting ready to swing on someone. Then the surprint, which is all red, is really nice. You've got this sort of dragon shape, that's a very iconic-looking dragon artwork that takes up a large portion of it. Then behind him, you see his sensei. You see him as a young man kicking a robot arm off. And then you see him all snuggle bunny with his lady love, Princess Projecta. And I do love that little image. It looks to me, or he's kind of got his arm, like they're like really close together. He's got his arm around her. She's sort of holding his hand. And you can see her. She's got this like mesh on her hand. It looks to me like a really cute couple in the 1980s going to a Madonna concert, is what that looks like to me. Now his occupation, this is interesting, Rob. He actually has the same occupation as you and me. He is a monarch consort, because knowing our wives, I mean, pretty much that's how that rolls for us. Thankfully, we're both lucky in that regard. And he's known for have fighting. He fought Superboy to a standstill one time, which is great. Now I'm going to ask you about the art before I get into the mandatory comments Dr. Ange will require me to say. So, what do you think of it?
It's drawn within an inch of its life. I mean, all
Yeah.
the Steve Lytle pieces are great, but this one's so beautifully designed. I mean,
Yeah.
again, it's drawn well, but just so beautiful. I love his pose. I like it's a, you
Yeah.
know, he's ready to bring the pain down on somebody. I love the fade of the surprint that it fades from a deep red to this almost transparent down at the bottom. The design of it, the way you follow the dragon shape, you know, as it kind of winds around like it's a winding road. I mean, again, every Steve Lytle piece is great. It was just absolutely fantastic. I love the black tunic has no shading on it. It's just solid
Yeah,
black. So that really pops up. But this one's just, you know, again, if we're doing we can do like our top 10 Legion listings, this would be up there because I think this is just so absolutely fantastically drawn.
and given the minimal amount of colors that are used, I mean, basically it's red and yellow, and the white and black is really all you've got for them. I mean, there's some flesh color and some brown, whatever, but for the
Yeah,
most part,
black,
that's
yellow, white, red. That's pretty
yeah.
much it. Yeah.
And it's striking. It's really well. And again, his frontal full color picture is just great. It looks so good. So, as Dr. Ainge requires us by our bylaws, I have to mention that there's a history here with Karate Kid and Nemesis Kid. So, Nemesis Kid and they actually premiered in the same issue together, which is actually Adventure Comics number 346 in 1966. In that same issue, you get the introduction of Princess Projecta, Pharaoh Lad, Nemesis Kid, and Karate Kid. And across the cover, it has all four of them. And it says, "One of us is a traitor." I wonder who it is, the kid with the name Nemesis. But so Nemesis Kid is around for a long time, but eventually you get to the storyline where there's a big battle and Nemesis Kid delivers a mortal wound to Karate Kid, basically causing his death. And Nemesis Kid's power is to develop whatever power is necessary to beat his foe. So with Karate Kid, you think he might become invulnerable or super strong. No, in fact, Nemesis Kid develops the power of better karate. So he delivers the mortal blow to Karate Kid. Then Karate Kid's wife, Princess Projecta, straight up executes Nemesis Kid by breaking his neck. So huge moment for the Legion and in those stories. And it's one of Dr. Ainge's favorites. So for more on the character, you can check out the Legion of Superheroes cartoon. You can check out the Legion of Super Bloggers, or go find his 1970s rockin' series where he comes to the 20th century and he's Karate Kid because Kung Fu was cool in the 70s.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They really were. He also appears apparently on an animated DVD, JLA Adventures Trapped in Time. So who knew? All right. And this is from Who's Who number 12, I should mention, by the way.
Next up, boop, 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 beep, boop, boop, boop. We haven't been doing the randomizer that much. I forgot about that. We got to give the people what they want. The Lord of Time, one of the great question mark Justice League villains, first appeared in Justice. I know you don't like the JLA villains, except for Starro. First appeared Justice League America, number 10. Basically, he's you know, it's funny. His name is the Lord of Time, but then he's also called the Time Lord. Like they kind of go back and forth. He's like Time
Yep.
Lord, Lord of Time's fine.
Not to be confused with Doctor Who, folks.
No, This is drawn by Mike Chen and Greg Theakston. Mike Chen done many, many great artistic jobs in his life, but probably most famous for being one of my instructors in the third year of the Joe Kubert School. I will tell you some stories about Mike Chen. Mike was not only what's there to say about the Lord of Time? Other than the fact that he has a really cool kind of final story, which I covered on, you'd mentioned the monitor tapes. I did the same thing. I made an appearance on that show as well, talking about this issue. But anyway, Mike Chen, he not only was he a instructor at the Kubert School, he was also one of the faculty, like one of the staff. And so he had like other positions at the school and stuff. And he was very serious. He was just a very serious guy. He took himself very seriously, but he was just not a goof off the way some of the other instructors were, which of course made the rest of us want to make him laugh. Right.
Oh my
because
gosh.
You know what I mean? Cause you're giving me a target. You know what I mean? So, so I used to try and make him laugh. And then, there was something, I forget even why we did it, but there was something to the effect of that. We strung up toilet paper in the door frame of one of our classrooms because we're children. And Mike started to walk out and he let us know in no uncertain terms to take that down. And he started to walk out the door. And then I said something stupid. Again, surprise, surprise.
Right.
And that stopped Mike. He turned, leaned back into the doorframe just as the toilet paper was sort of fluttering over his head. And it just made us all laugh that this very dignified man was standing amid these toilet paper streamers. And I have to think he did that on purpose just to be goofy and stuff like that. So I always got along with him. I always liked him. He actually taught us there was a business course. It was about like how to be a professional artist.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what we had him for. And so we were doing stuff like that. So I always liked Mike and I'm friends with him on Facebook to this day. Wonderful guy.
Wow. Okay.
And a great artist. And great art. He's done a couple of, he did the Pack Rat one for Atari Force. Like that's really great. Here he's inked by Greg Theakston, which I mentioned. I don't know if this is like the greatest combo in the world necessarily. Mike's work is, this looks very Kirby-ish, and I have to think it's just because Greg Theakston is inking it.
Okay.
I do like the surprint of like that Mike really, you know, brought it. I mean, he draws the entire Justice League
right. Attacking
the Lord of Time. Like he didn't cheap out, man. He drew like all 9 members at the time. So, and I also love that he's standing there, you know, hands on hips, legs akimbo, and then there's the surprint of his face, and it's kind of the same.
Right.
Face, except he's kind of like,
it's so funny that they're right next to each other. So. And then I assume the really smoking hot woman off his left shoulder is his daughter, probably.
That's his daughter, yes.
Okay,
that's
his daughter. And that's him, creepy old man, there as well. I think.
Well, he's not creepy old man. He's just an old man. I mean, right, you know, I mean, don't be an age. Don't be ageist. Chad.
Well, bald people are scary.
Okay, that's true.
So I do have a Michael Chen story, oddly enough. I do another podcast that you don't listen to called Once Upon a Geek. And on there, we actually just talked about, because we covered issue 8. And in the letters page, you know, Paris Cullins famously started the Blue Devil series, but then he left fairly quickly. And they sort of searched around for a new artist for a long time. In the letters page of issue number 8, they promised that Mike Chen would be the new regular artist on Blue Devil beginning with issue 11, which obviously did not become the case.
No, it did not happen.
But that would have been interesting, especially sitting here looking at this Lord of Time entry and being really impressed by it. I would have been very interested to see what he could have done ongoing on a Blue Devil book. That would have been really nice.
I could have seen that. He had a really nice, clean, very expressive line. I could have seen that. That might have been a good fit.
Well, back to the art. I mean, you're right. The surprint, and I don't know how much of that's Theakston and how much is Chen, but it looks fantastic. The whole JLA running at their profile side. The Lord of Time, who I've never been impressed with, actually looks pretty boss there because he's repelling the attack of every single JLA member. I like that he used sort of just this strange, it looks like a giant iPad, really, but this rounded corner rectangle iconography in the background. It doesn't really represent anything, I don't think, but it looks nice. It's a nice way to hang the art together.
Yeah.
And then the surprint actually bleeds a tiny little bit into the personal data, which I don't remember seeing before. I'm sure someone's going to tell me 4 times that it did happen, but I found that kind of cool looking.
Yeah, that's right. It does. That's unusual. That's unusual. Yep. He has an unusual end for a character in that he basically gives up being a villain and goes to live in the far-flung future of the world. And then in this issue of Justice League, Steel ends up getting bopped into that time and discovers him. And it was kind of cool because Steel was like, you know, here's Steel kind of running into one of the JLA's classic villains who has long since retired. He's kind of living this sort of sad life, although he's got his daughter and these kind of like the duplicate sons that he cloned and stuff, like all this crazy stuff. But it was kind of like a really melancholy story. And I like the idea of like one villain just saying, you know what, I don't want to be the villain anymore. I'm just going to disappear. And he lives in like the year 8632 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. It's a good story. That was one of my earlier issues as a JLA collector, actually. And I love the way they redesigned Steel's costume at that point, too, with the open the mask at that point, or his hair sticking out.
We famously love those masks.
We do. So it was really good. I do have questions here from reading this entry, because you're my JLA expert. I mean, you even ran a blog on this thing for years. The way they outline the origin here, it's a little confusing. It's like it's mixed up with the other JLA adventures with Felix Faust in like the Demons 3. Mm-hmm. Did the Lord of Time story cross several issues? Which I don't think it did.
No, it doesn't.
Okay. They make it sound like it did, which is strange the way they say it here. But anyway, he's also responsible for one of the big JSA crossovers with Enemy Ace and Jonah Hex and Viking Prince and Miss Liberty and Black Pirate, which is pretty cool. And now, interestingly enough, they don't call him Lord of Time anymore. Now he's called Epoch, which is actually a pretty decent name if you got to be a time travel type character. So first appearance all the way back in 1962 in JLA number 10. Wow. Yeah. All right. And that is all we have to say about that. All right. Up next is Lord Satanus from issue number 13. To be specific, that is spelled S-A-T-A-N-I-S, which is important, and we'll talk about it in a minute. The art here is by Kurt Swan and Bob Smith, if you can see it, because the art's so small. I do like the logo. It's kind of at a jaunty angle. It's really just, you know, handwritten name, but it looks kind of fun. But the art, yeah, the art's really small, because this particular layout for a Who's Who page, they put all the data on the bottom, so the artist gets, I don't know, a third of a page, maybe, at the top, across, and it makes it hard to see a full figure of the character because it's kind of small. So, but you've got him there in his black and red costume with his big Magneto helmet and his hands are glowing yellow. And in the surprint, a nice green surprint, you've got a close-up of his helmet because you don't know who's under the mask, so you don't see his face. You see him in a magical battle with this, what would be an unnamed woman to us, but we find out it's his wife because she's got stars on her costume and fishnets, so you know it must mean magic. Then you see him zapping Superman, and he's got like these little bands surrounding Superman, and Superman is trapped. So what do you think of the art here, buddy?
It's fine. It's fine. He's got a lot of history for a character that was, what, 3 years old?
Yes.
At this point?
Exactly, right.
Right? You would, from, if you look at this listing, you're like, oh my God, he must be like a Superman villain from like 1950. And then you're looking at like Action Comics 527. What? Yep. You know? So.
I don't know if I said, did I say it's Kurt Swan and Bob Smith?
Yes.
I don't know if
okay. Yes, you did.
Which is interesting because, like, you know, Kurt Swan is someone that Chris Franklin will yell at us if we're mean. But Bob Smith's a great inker. So it's sort of an interesting combination. The line work is clean, certainly. But it just does. It's not very exciting, you know. It's kind of the disappointing thing, I guess. His origin is crazy. So he is born more than a million years from now, when magic has supplanted science as the important studies, and it's a really complicated backstory. But the short version is Lord Satanus and his wife were both in competition for the same magical stone. This brings them back in time to the early 1980s, where they're battling one another over getting the stone, and the chance to filter, which makes no sense, but to filter the stone's power through Superman's body. It gets even more complicated because Superman is then split into two with different sets of powers. One of the Superman dies, but he gets better, of course. And in the end, everything goes back to normal, and no one ever cared about this version of Lord Satanus again. So yes, you mentioned Action Comics 527 from 1982. And the reason I spelled his name earlier is a very specific reason. So this is Lord Satanus, Satan with an IS. Whereas in post-crisis, this essentially same character is spelled, instead of IS, US. So it's S-A-T-A-N-U-S. And apparently, if you add horns to this costume, tweak it just a tiny bit, change one letter, you get a whole new creator credit. So,
wow, yeah, really?
Yes. Okay. So The post-crisis Lord Satanus is credited to the creators from post-crisis. And the reason I know this so well is because I am currently looking at, in my office, a plaque that is hanging on my wall. Because I brought this up when you and I covered the loose leaf edition of Lord Satanus, and Michael Bailey did not know that. And so he sent me a plaque that says, I read that.
Oh, okay.
It
That, I
says,
remember that.
it says Recognition Award presented to the Irredeemable Shag on July 2nd, 2023. Shag pointed out a Superman fact to Michael Bailey. And Michael Bailey literally sent me a plaque. So Lord Satanus will forever hold a place in my heart for that reason.
There you go.
You mentioned not being around long. He literally had 9 appearances in Action Comics. Then he had a little spot in Who's Who and a little spot in Crisis, but that's all you get. That's it.
He's a creation of Marv Wolfman, so he must have really liked him because that's a lot of appearances in a short period of time.
Yeah. I think it was an ongoing story. It's kind of probably what it was, but
Well, still though, I mean, that's still, I mean, that's multiple part stories for a character. It's not like it's Luthor or Brainiac. It's kind of funny. I'm sitting here kind of going, oh, that's a lot of appearances. And yet the knock on Superman is that it's always just Luthor and Brainiac. So like, okay, let's have some of these other villains get a chance to defeat Superman. Come on.
Yep. Well, that was Marv Wolfman trying to make his stamp on Bronze Age Superman, if I remember right. So, yeah. All right. For more, probably the best place to check out is Michael Bailey's Fortress of Baileytude podcasting network and his Bailey Planet website.
The man is willing to admit when he doesn't know something, too. It's an admirable trait.
All right. Up next, we got another Superman foe.
Yeah. Speaking of Bronze Age Superman, Luthor, the Earth One Luthor, or Luthor Two, once again, drawn by Kurt Swan and George Perez. And I love this combination. This reminds me of Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. I know that's a story of Michael Bailey doesn't love, but okay, this isn't his show. Let's go on. This is Luthor in his superpower suit, in his power suit that debuted in Action Comics 544, which it'll kind of looks like Nicholas Holt is wearing in the stills we've seen
Oh yeah.
for
Oh yeah, for sure,
Superman
for
Man
sure.
of Tomorrow. So that's exciting. Now, this is one of those things where DC had to go back and pick an arbitrary, not necessarily arbitrary, but they had to go back and pick a first appearance because they couldn't say Action Comics number one because that's the old Luthor. So here they said Adventure Comics 271. They decided that one. I didn't look that up, but I'm betting that's like a retelling of his origin of the bald thing, and they're like, all right, that's a good spot for that. It makes
Yes
sense.
and yes and no. You're exactly right. It is that story, but it's specifically how Superboy met Lex Luthor.
There you go.
So
Makes
that's
sense.
why
Why
they
not?
does yeah.
Sure.
And yeah, of course the baldness comes into that. But that is where they decide to begin the Silver Age version. Yeah.
Yeah. This is, again, beautiful listing. Like I said, we're mixed on Kurt Swan. We don't need to go on and on about it. But him and Prez as an inker, like, I really brings out something in Swan that I really like. I wish they had a chance to do more. What do you think of this era of Luthor, the power suit? I kind of like, I mean, I love the figure. I love the absolute superpowers. I thought it was great. It's a little, it's like a little goofy. It's kind of a way to kind of ramp him up. But at the same time, you're like, well, you know what? Why not? He's like this super genius guy. Why not give himself a little more physical heft? And we see here, him punching Superman in the Serpent. We see him in jail and stuff like that. And then we see him in his giant, like, Metron chair or whatever the hell he's got going there. There's a lot of history. But of course, because he's Luthor, he's like probably like the third most famous villain in all of comics.
I love that you asked my opinion and then just kept talking. So to go back to your question for like 5 minutes ago, what's my opinion on this? I love the power suit era. It looks fantastic, and it put Luthor on the same physical level as Superman, which is great. And by the way, thank you, Randomizer. Boop, 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 boop. You are the gift that keeps on giving. We did an episode of Who's Who Review about the time the Superman movie came out, and bizarrely, we got a Superman that about the same time that issue came out. We've got the Legion of Doom Fire and Water draft, folks. So we have done a couple draft episodes now. We are releasing the Legion of Doom draft episode this week. We recorded it a while ago, and yet the randomizer throws us Lex Luthor, who everyone has to pick a Luthor, by the way, on their Legion of Doom. So this is like such a gift from the randomizer. So thank you. What a wonderfully cosmically, perfectly balanced thing. Now, I love the power suit. It's a lot of fun. I will say this, interesting. The power suit here. He's inside like the headpiece, it's always had those two phalanges who come up around his neck, right? Or collars or whatever. Here he's actually behind like a glass dome. I've never noticed that glass dome before. I always thought the head was exposed to the air. So that's new for me. But the thing that I think takes away from this thing is the same thing I had with the Lord Satana's issue or entry is the layout. They did that thing again where all the text is on the bottom, so you got to cram all the art into one third of the top. Like if they had done this more in like two columns, you could have got this great shot of Luther in that, outfit really big, which would have been great. I would have loved that. But anyway, other than the art being a little small, yeah, it's gorgeous. The power suit looks great. I love the goofiness of it. And you actually get Luther in his, Challenge of the Super Friends outfit. He's back as to us, but that's clearly the purple and green suit where he's punching Superman. And it's really, really good. The entry itself, like if you read the text, it gets into the bonkers, Bronze Age, Silver Age silliness, with all the former ruler of the planet, Lexor, blah, 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 all that. Oh my gosh. All that craziness, everything about his sister. But yeah, no, it's a beautiful entry. And yeah, like you said, Kurt Swan and George Perez together is just a really nice combination. It's peanut butter and chocolate.
It's great stuff. It's great. I love the listing of the many layers, various layers changing from time to time. I like
You
that.
know what I found was interesting is the entry is just Luther. That's it. No Lex, no anything like just Luther. Which I thought was that's an interesting choice. I didn't know why they would do that. So, but it's specifically obviously Luther 2, Electric Boogaloo of Earth 1, and this is from issue 14 of Who's Who. So, if you want more on Lex Luthor, obviously, you might have been aware of him. He's been in a movie or two, whatever. But most importantly, this week, check out the Legion of Doom draft on the Fire and Water Podcast Network for more Lex Luthor talk.
Does it get heated?
Oh yeah, it does. Oh
Okay.
man.
Oh boy.
There are some hurt feelings,
Oh
and
geez.
there and
Why
there.
do you want to just watch the world burn, Jag? I don't understand.
I'm not the one who did the feeling hurting. It's other people on this network. So,
Okay.
it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of, I think I mean I'm biased, obviously I was part of it, but there's a lot of laughs. I mean, we're just laughing nonstop in it. So it's a lot of fun. So anyway, check that out coming to the FW Presents podcast feed. All right, up next, you go from Luther to the insanity of Matter Eater Lad. So from issue 15, the art here is by Keith Giffen and Bob Smith. You've got a very large full figure of Matter Eater Lad in the very 1980s style of Keith Giffen. So a lot, minimal amount of lines, a lot of blackness, but it looks great. It's a great figure of him with his bold green and yellow suit. He is. It looks like he's just burst through a wall, but I assume the implication is he's eaten through the wall. I don't.
Right. Yeah.
That's my
Yeah. I
only.
was talking that he chomped his way through it. Yes.
That is my only criticism of this art piece. Because also you get the surprint behind him, which looks great. You have an apple core that he ate. You have like a metal rod that he ate. But like, there should be a little more of him using his power, I think, on the entry. Other than that, but anyway, what do you think of the art here?
It's cool. I mean, again, it's him and his, it's Giffen in his like Munoz phase.
Yeah.
And so it's very cartoony, but it doesn't bother me because these characters are all goofy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they're in their goofy comedy phase. So, it's fine. It's a nice contrast. I like the magenta of the serpent and stuff. So I agree. It would have been funny to like, it might have been funny to see him like munching on the personal data box or something if they wanted to go that far, like Ursula Ada kind of thing, and he's actually eating that or whatever. But other than that, it's come on, it's Matter Eater Lad. How much analyzing was I going to do when this came out?
Right, exactly. Now he's funny, but we always joke about the Legion of Substitute Heroes. He's not a sub; he's a legit member of the team, and he's from the planet Bismol. Come on,
Bismol,
as in
yes.
Pepto-Bismol. Come on, people, this is great. Everyone on his planet can eat anything. They've developed this ability to digest anything. He joins the Legion, which is bizarre to me that the Legion even accepted him. But then it gets crazier. He goes into Bismolian politics. He ends up becoming a politician, which is also just funny. I mean, the character is just pitch perfect for Keith Giffen. It's so much fun, so funny. He's obviously a favorite of Keith's. He does a lot with him in the 5YL as well, which is great. The logo's kind of generic, just looks like a font, really, more than anything. But yeah, super fun. I love this. His first appearance is Adventure Comics 303 from 1962. This character had been around a long damn time. So for more on him, of course, you can look at the Legion of Super Bloggers, or you can check out the Legion of Superheroes cartoon.
Right. Boop, 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 beep, boop, 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 boo.
There's our old friend.
Rostov, a character from Warlord, first appeared in Warlord number 47, drawn by Ron Randall, also a graduate of the Joe Kubert School, should mention. For whatever, when I saw this listing, I was sure he was one of the characters that got the an action figure from Remco in that weird warlord line. But that is not accurate. He did
what?
No, he's not one of them. It's,
oh, I also wrote down Remco toys.
Yeah, to no. I looked it up. There was Machiste and Hercules and Iraq, and there's one of the guy whose name's character. His name escapes me, but it's not Rostov. I don't know why I always thought it was Rostov, but it's not. Rostov did not get an action.
Oh, it's Deimos.
There's another one on. There's another one.
Oh, okay.
On top of that.
Warlord himself, but yeah.
Yep. No, there's yet another one after that. I just don't remember who it was. But anyway, Rostov. His name is his name is Mykola Rostov. I don't want to say his secret identity. They don't have secret identities on Warlord. He is a fencing instructor and the lover of Mariah Romanov, who is Mariah, who got a listing in Who's Who. After learning he had inherited the curse of the werewolf, Rostov drove Mariah away to protect her, but he later followed her to the dimensional realm of Skitaris. That's how Warlord comes into this. And then he went back in time, too. It's like, oh, already you're like, wait a minute. He was a werewolf, and then he went to Skitaris, and then he went back in time. You're like, this is a lot of sci-fi concepts. Mike Grell was just throwing everything at the wall to see what stuck.
And they fit it all into a half-page entry.
Fit it all into a half-page entry. Yes. It's, you know what? It's perfectly fine. It's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Nothing terribly exciting, but there's nothing wrong with it either.
No, the art's fine. I mean, he's in werewolf form attacking Warlord. He's there teaching Mariah how to fight. I had to look Mariah up. I didn't remember her. Once I saw her image from Warlord, I'm like, oh, she's the super hot, sexy redhead.
She's like the bikini costume.
That's, like barely there.
Yeah.
Bikini costume. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It is sort of interesting to me that he's one of the people that came from our world and went to Skartaris rather than people that he met there. So that's kind of cool. And by the way, Jason Blood called and wants his hair back as well. So. from Russia, by the way, this guy. So from Russia with love. So first appearance is Warlord number 47 from 1981. And for more on him, I was going to tell you to go look for a Remco toy, but I would have been lying to you.
Nope.
But you can listen to the Warlords Worlds podcast with our friends Darren and Ruth.
There you go. All right. Next up, Star Labs, drawn by Ross Andrew, the great Ross Andrew, who really didn't do a whole lot for Who's Who, despite the fact he drew thousands of pages of DC Comics.
Right.
He didn't, by this point, I think he'd moved back to Marvel, so he wasn't doing a lot of DC stuff. But here he's drawing Star Labs. It's inked by Ricardo Villagran, and we see Dr. Janet Clyburn, super hottie Janet Clyburn, and some of the other people that work there. Now, the thing that's frustrating about this is I looked this up. I think this probably happened the last time we did the Star Labs.
I know where you're going, and we've talked about
it. I looked this up because this is based on a real building, because I've been to the real building. But if you Google it, you cannot find anything on this real building. And the thing is I remember, because of course the distinct thing about the Star Labs building is that it's at an angle. The bottom half of it is at an angle and then it shoots straight up. So it's just an unusual design as opposed to just being a straight tower. And I remember back when we were at Qbert, one of the assignments that we had to go do for one of our classes was we had to go to some art museums and just go to art museums. It wasn't extra credit. It was part of the assignment. It was just the kind of, she wanted, it was like one of our design teachers, not the comic book people. So she wanted to broaden our horizons a little bit. Good luck for some of those guys. But we went to New York a bunch of times and we're walking down the street in New York and dang, if we don't see the Star Labs building, it's right. We were like, oh my God, it's a real thing. Like, we didn't know that. And then it made sense that whoever was the first artist at Star Labs first appeared in Superman 246. I'm guessing it's Kurt Swan. But whoever designed it must have known the building because DC was based in New York for many decades. And they probably knew it and just said, oh, let's turn it into Star Labs. But I'll be damned if you can find it on Google anywhere. There is no, I could not find a single mention of what this is really based on. So I like that. But Star Labs, you know, features very heavily in the DC universe, specifically the DC Superman comics, mostly DC Comics Presents. But, you know, it's cool. I like it's a central location to the DCU.
If you want your answer, just go look at the Fire and Water Who's Who podcast episode number 20, and I bet you the answer is in the comment section. I'm pretty sure you asked this question last time.
I did not even think to look there. That's interesting.
I think that's probably your best resources.
Okay.
When I was doing some of my research, I was like Googling for stuff, And it's the search cited one of our comment sections about Karate Kid. Actually, cited the comment section of one of our podcast episodes. I'm like, oh my
Wow.
gosh! So
Okay.
we made it if we're coming up in Google searches. So a couple things. I remember this building like, here it's it's like a straight angle, and then it goes straight up. I remember seeing some people draw it more of a curve. Like, it was more of a sloping curve. And that's how I always like to see Star Labs, is the sloping curve rather than the angular thing. I mean, it still looks great no matter what. You already said it here, but the most important thing you're going to hear today, folks, is the name Dr. Jeanette Clyburn. I mean, I really don't need to say anything else other than that. I will say, I'm pretty sure Ross Andrew did not draw the inset picture of Dr. Murray Takamoto. That does not look anything like a Ross Andrew drawing to me. You
Why
see
do
what
you
I'm talking
think
about?
that? Yeah, no, I could see that, Ross Andrew.
Okay, all right, if you say so. I love the Star Labs concept, right? It's great. I mean, obviously they did really great things with it in the Flash TV show. But for me, like, I first fell in love with it in the Will Payton Starman series, because they the Star Labs, he was out in I think Arizona or New Mexico, I can't remember, but they had a Star Labs office there, and he was constantly dealing with them and their that installation of Star Labs. It was supporting characters. So I fell in love with Star Labs all the way back then. I mean, of course, they appear throughout everything and Blue Devil everywhere. But just it's a I don't know. It's a fixture, I guess, is the best way to put it. And I love it. First appearance was Superman number 246 in 1971. As I said, you can find it in a million comic books, and surprisingly, you can find Star Labs on random T-shirts at the mall. So. All right, up next, our last entry of the 13 randomized ones. So here we go. Boop, 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 is an incredibly gorgeous entry for The Unknown Soldier. So the art here is by Joe Kubert. You've got at the top the giant Unknown Soldier logo, which is clearly from the comic. I actually like, again, these digital versions, you can see really good. You can see actually like the camouflage sort of in the Unknown Soldier there in the logo itself. Then you've got a picture of him with his arms outstretched. In amazing Joe Kubert style. The folds of the clothing is what really stands out to me, and his green, fatigues, and he's got his boots and everything. But then he's got the famous look of him being, his face is bandaged, like the Invisible Man almost, like you can't see what his face originally looks like. Then in the surprint, you've got some of the people he was in disguise as, including Adolf Hitler. Then you see machine gun fire just barely. You see crosses from, I think that's a cemetery. And then this huge profile shot, very tight close-up profile shot. It's not even his full profile, it's just a sliver of it, of the Unknown Soldier with the bandaged face, and he's looking at you like side-eyed, and it looks amazing. What do you think of this art, buddy?
That's fantastic. Beautifully laid out, drawn by Joe Kubert. The design of it is great. I love that the little inset background kind of stops two-thirds of the way down. It's just a nice design element. I don't know what the Unknown Soldier is doing exactly. Like, his arms are outstretched. He's kind of, he's looking at something. I don't really know what that is. But that's fine. You know what I mean? He was certainly a man of action, but it's also, a slightly more peaceful kind of, I don't know, like kind of just crying to the heavens sort of thing. But it's.
I was thinking it was angsty. That was what I was thinking. It
Yeah,
was like,
okay.
sort of frustrated, yelling
I guess so.
frustration. But
Yeah,
he's
he
not,
looks
his
sad,
mouth's
right?
closed though, but
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, he looks angry in the inset, but he's sad in the drawing, and the figure. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. The Unknown Soldier, he died in his last issue. So they really, and it gets into that here. It says he, quote unquote, helped Hitler kill himself in his bunker, and then he died after that. So they really wrapped up. They really ended it with a bang. And as we've discovered on various episodes of this show and other shows, like the Unknown Soldier backups were just like the greatest comics DC ever published. There was like a Captain Fear backup by Walt Simonson, and there was one other one that we were like, man, these backups of the Unknown Soldier were just like amazing. It was like one was drawn by like Alex Toth. It was like, God dang, these things are absolutely amazing. I mean, absolutely deserves it. The guy had his own comic for decades. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful piece.
So I was going to ask, so we haven't played this game in a long time. Any guess of how many issues he had in the in the classic era?
Well, I know that Unknown Soldier's final issue is number 268. Why do I know that? I don't know.
Okay. All right.
And I believe that Star Spangled War Stories became the Unknown
Jeez.
Soldier. So that would mean if he first appeared in 151 and his last issue was 268, that would be 117 issues.
You are exactly right to the penny, sir.
There
so,
you go.
Wow.
It's amazing
well
the stuff I know, right? You know, and then, you know what that comes from? You know what I'm saying? That is from years as a child reading like it was a book, the Overstreet Price Guides.
Oh, right.
I read those like they were novels, and I absorbed all of the minutiae of – because they were big on title becomes this as of this issue.
Yep.
And so that's how I remember. I used to for about 4 or 5 years there, I was getting them every year, and I just read them cover to cover like they were books.
I spent a lot of time. That's what helped me do back issue dives back then. I'd flip through it.
Yeah, sure.
And it'd be like, you know, issue 27, the first appearance of a such and such character. I'm like, all right, I'm looking for that issue now. You know, that kind of thing. So his story is, you know, we don't know his name. Obviously, he's the unknown soldier. He had a brother named Harry. They both joined the army in the early days of World War II. And Harry was killed saving his brother from a Japanese grenade. Interesting. Two different entries. Guys throwing themselves on grenades here. The brother, who's the unknown soldier, he survives, but he's horribly disfigured. So, and Harry had once told him that in one man in the right place could mean the difference in winning a battle. So his brother took that to heart. So he becomes an undercover agent. He's physically in peak condition. Plus, he's a master of disguise with makeup and wigs and costumes and stuff like that. So he's able to disguise himself as anyone else. And he's one of the most hated soldiers by the Nazis. They hate this guy. You already mentioned the part where he helps Hitler commit suicide.
They put that in quotes, helps.
I know. I love that. And the way he died, actually, is sort of sweet. He dies trying to save a child from an explosion in Berlin. So he sort of dies the way his brother did. Trying to save someone else. So really fast. I mean, you read this entry and you're like, damn, I want to read more of these stories. And I've only read one or two Unknown Soldier comics, and they were always good. These War Soldier comics really deserve more attention. They're fantastic. In fact, if you want to hear more about Unknown Soldier and other war comics, you should check out the Weird Warriors podcast, you know, where they dive into this stuff. But the war comics are all but forgotten by most comic book readers nowadays. And there's I went down a rabbit hole and read a ton of Haunted Tank stories, obviously Enemy Ace we've talked about Balloon Buster. I mean, all these went down different rabbit holes of reading, and they're always fantastic. So I could do with some more war comics. That'd be good stuff.
And he has come back. They've done miniseries with him and stuff like that. It's not like, you know, that was it after that. So he has been a character in the DC, the greater publishing universe since.
Yep. All right, so that is our 13 entries. So, Rob, we're going to do Zoom's Who in a minute, but I got to ask you. Actually, let's do Zoom's Who first.
Okay.
So we're gonna talk about Doibie Dickles, famously the sidekick of Plastic Man, apparently, or Green Lantern, whichever you choose. This comes from Zoom's Who, issue number 2. The art here is by Gil Kane and Sid Green, obviously compiled, though, by the Yukinori family. And so you've got this image in the forefront of Doibie. The reason I'm struggling with it is all the name Doibie. Well, it all comes from a hat. Like the character, his name is Charles Dickles, by the way. He has trouble pronouncing the word Derby.
Derby.
Hat. So you could say Derby Dickles. You could say Doibie Dickles. Anyway, I've never heard it pronounced authoritatively, so I don't know for sure. I don't count you as authoritative. So anyway, you've got Doibie there in the front. He's got his bright yellow shirt and suspenders, and he's kind of short and heavy, and he's carrying a giant, you know, pipe wrench, like he's going to smack somebody with it. And then in the background, you've got a very Gil Kane close-up of Doibie's face. Then you've got Doibie running with Alan Scott. You see his taxi cab as he's driving it, and then you see the love of his life, his princess Ramia from the planet Mirg, and little hearts floating even between him. I mean, what a fantastically put together piece! This looks great, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it does. It looks, you know, I mean, this is one of those characters that, you know, you could see when they were compiling Who's Who, they were like, look, we only have so many pages, and we can't do the funny sidekicks because every Golden Age superhero had a funny sidekick. But he was also in like every issue of Green Lantern for like, you know, 7 years. So for Pete's sakes, you know, he deserves it. Why not? And the reason he could say Doibie is because it's a play on the way characters in the 40s movies would say those things. Like the guys with the Brooklyn accent would drop the R and say it with that, you know, Moigatoid, stuff like that. So that's the play. That's why, even though I've never heard another human ever say Doibie Dickles, I, as a child, never had a problem pronouncing it because I was like, oh, this is like a play on every 40s Abbott and Costello movie and things like that.
So you should be happy with the height and weight here. He's because you always say it's never right. You always say, "Oh, there's no way that person's that skinny." He's 4'2", 210 pounds.
Yeah,
So
I mean,
that
he's
should make
big. He's a big guy. He's a big round guy. I mean, so what the hell?
So the history here, again, as documented by one of the Eukonores, so World War I, he was a driver for the military in France. He became a taxi driver later in the U.S. He meets Green Lantern and assists in capturing some gangsters. Becomes a regular partner to Green Lantern and later the personal driver for Alan Scott. Then years later, he helped in as you do helps an alien princess, and they fall in love and get married. So here we go, another monarch consort, Rob. So though he's listed as king, so I don't really know who had the upper, boss job, her or him. I would think it'd be her since she's actually royalty. But
Yeah, I
whatever.
think
Anyway,
he's just married into it.
yeah. So just like we did. So now
Exactly.
I do want to mention one thing about Doivy that I love, and this isn't in the entry, but years later. In the 1990s or early 2000s, he appeared as a supporting character for a little while in the Young Justice comic. This is the one that Peter David wrote. And he was part of a team that was called Old Justice. And it was comprised of really, really old people. People that were old sidekicks that had grown and become very old people, like senior citizens. So it's Doibie, it's Dan the Dynamite, Mary, Girl of a Thousand Tricks, Neptune Perkins, which wasn't really a sidekick, but anyway, and then Ma Hunkel's kids, the Cyclone Kids, and one of Our Man's Minutemen. So it's these really old people running around, and they're convinced these young heroes and Young Justice aren't responsible enough. So they were actually sort of antagonists for a little while in Young Justice, which was just adorable. I loved it. So it was so good. So yeah, first appearance is All American Comics number 27. So it's a great entry. Once again, the Eukonores have outdone themselves. It is absolutely stunning. I love it. It's a lot of fun, and it's a character who deserves the attention. I mean, we all knew who he was from all those old stories. So
Yeah, totally.
okay, so now Rob, going back, we've got 13 entries, 13 amazing entries, and you've got to pick your best one. So what do you got, buddy?
This is really easy, not because the ones that I'm not picking aren't good. It's because the ones I am picking are so transcendently good
Yeah.
that it's th this
I
is
think we have the
super
same
easy.
three, so go ahead.
Dr. Midnight, Karate Kid, and Unknown Soldier.
We're done.
There we go. There we go.
Exactly right, all the way across. I mean,
Yeah.
there's a lot of other ones. Like the Lex Luthor one's amazing. The Brother
Yep.
Blood one's
Yeah.
amazing. Battery to
There's a
Light,
lot of
all of
good
them.
ones here. Yeah. It's just the three, the Matt Wagner, Dr. Midnight is like, an all-timer. It just is. So there you go.
So stinking good. Okay, well, folks, Rob and I, we are going to take a break. We are going to do a little podcast promo. And don't forget, by the way, you can check our gallery, which is on fireandwaterpodcast.com, to see these entries. We're going to do this podcast promo break. And when we come back, we're going to cover your feedback from the last two episodes of the Who's Who podcast.
Across the DC multiverse, countless worlds exist in parallel, each with its own history, its own heroes, its own destiny. I'm DC Dave, and this is Infinite Earths, a guide to the DC multiverse, a travelogue and field guide to the worlds beyond the familiar. Each episode, we chart a different Earth, exploring its origins, its defining stories, and the cosmic architecture that shaped it. From the earliest multiverse experiments to the mythic forces that rewrote reality itself, every world has a place on the map. The Orrery is waiting. Join me. Let's explore.
Maybe I can do a podcast about comic books. No, everybody does a podcast about comic books. Maybe I can do a podcast about TV shows. Now, there's a lot of podcasts out there covering TV shows. I know, a podcast about movies. It's too general. A lot of people do podcasts about movies. Star Wars movies. No, everybody talks about Star Wars movies. Need to do a podcast that covers movies and television shows and comics and all the pop culture I loved growing up. Wait a minute. The Pop Culture Basement Podcast, hosted by me, Mike Jamison, covering all the pop culture that I consumed and that we consumed during our formative years. Now available on all reputable podcast platforms. Join us down in the basement.
All right, folks, it is time for Who's Who, Hows, and Whys. It is our letter page for the Who's Who podcast. Now, this time out, we have got two different episodes to cover the feedback from, because we did the interview with Chuck Patton last time. We didn't want to bog the episode down with feedback, so we actually have feedback from two different episodes. So we're going to blow through this a little quickly, maybe more so than everyone who left a comment on the website is absolutely going to get recognized, I promise. But we may have to just move a little speedily through some of the comments. So first up, Rob, we're looking at the Who's Who review and number 12 from March 22nd, 2026. Why don't you start us off?
Yep, our first comment is, of course, from Isamu Hideaka Yukinori. Sorry, it's hard to say, Isamu. I should get better at this. He says, dead stupid fun show, Uncles Rob and Shag. After months of recovery from a broken wrist, I am finally back to doing my early morning bike rides again, and this was a perfect audio distraction from my annoying wrist brace. Thank you very much. Jeez, we didn't hear about that, Isamu. That's terrible.
I didn't know about that. That's awful. Yeah, I'm so glad you're on the mend, buddy.
Yeah. He says, Alan Moore's depiction of Adam Strange catching his Zeta beam in a public toilet was definitely quirky, but I expected Uncle Rob to mention the most important part of Alan Moore's Rand story in Swamp Thing 5758. It retconned Adam Strange's purpose on Rand to be essentially breeding stock to facilitate the reproductive survival of Rand's population, which had grown increasingly sterile, and Adam had no idea that Sardath was manipulating Adam in this way. While it was not stated, I like to think that Alana, one of the few fertile women on the planet, was not aware of this either, though she kept checking whether she was pregnant every morning, because that would mean that the loving relationship between Adam and Alana was genuine, even if the circumstances behind it was manipulated by Sardath. In any case, it's clear that Adam wasn't the only one working so hard to get laid. That story also retconned the Rainian public's perception of Adam Strange, not as a brilliant thinking hero, but as a throwback ape, because he comes from a comparatively primitive planet. I did remember all that, but I didn't bring it up because I don't like it.
Yeah,
why I left it out. Sometimes Alan Moore's reinventions went a little too far, but
I think the piece that has survived into later versions of Adam Strange has been the Sardath being a manipulative dick. I think that part
fine. Like, that's okay, but the rest of it's got a sinister cast that I just kind of was like, all right, Alan.
Well, and I think the Alana thing, I think she genuinely loves him. I don't think there's anything manipulative there. I think it's just Sardath. So, yep.
Yeah.
All right. Up next is movie Matt Sarois from the TV Movie Rewind podcast. He says, how random is it that two captains in this installment are literally captains? Not only that, their names are literally their names, Captain Compass and Captain Storm. It's also very random that you get a Deathstroke the Terminator the very week DC launched his new series. Your podcast is now influencing DC to do things before the episodes are even released. That is true power. I tell you, let's manifest a few things here, folks. Still waiting for a Firestorm collection, still waiting for a Blue Devil collection. Come on, let's make things happen.
I'd love to win the lottery, if that can be a thing. I have to use their powers for good. So Michael Bailey from the Bailey Planet website, Fortress of Bailey Tube podcast network, and expert plaque maker, says, Captain Compass isn't Murder, She Wrote. It's another CBS series. It's the NCIS of the 50s. Well, the only way that really tracks, Michael, is if there were 17 different Captain Compass series all set in different cities around the world.
There could have been. Give it time.
I work for CBS, and half of the stuff on the schedule is NCIS.
Right, exactly. NCIS, Poughkeepsie. So he also shares, and I can't believe I'm the one who highlighted this, fun fact about Neptune Perkins. His origin, as revealed in the Young All-Stars comic, was originally going to be Roy Thomas's origin for the Earth 2 Aquaman. And Mike has put some commentary in here, says, who totally existed. But the crisis happened, so it was ported over to Perkins. That's fascinating. Interesting.
That is. Now, I could tell you, Shag, I saw that comment, and I left it. I wanted you to have to say it.
Oh!
And if you didn't highlight it, I was going to highlight it. But I'm like, let me see if Shag will highlight it. And he fell into my trap. Thank you, Michael.
You suck. All right. Then we're from Gord Tolton from the Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast. And he says, there are other vigilantes? Why? Gord, that is awesome. Ranger Gord, I absolutely love that. And by the way, folks, if you want to hear Ranger Gord talk about the Vigilante podcast, obviously check out his. But he also was on a recent episode of JSA in the 90s talking about the Vigilante miniseries. We had a blast. It was great. Then up next is Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories. He talks about Dr. Destiny, and he asked, do they even explain why he's Skeletor now? And thankfully, Martin Gray rushes into the rescue. Martin Gray from Too Dangerous for a Girl blog. He says, Dr. Destiny lost the ability to dream due to a shrinking implant, a hypnotic suggestion to stop him using his mental powers. And then, quote, by the end of my prison term, I'd completely wasted away. I lost my hair. My skin turned waxy white. My body shriveled. So there you go. There is why he turned into the Skeletor lookalike.
Martin Gray continues. He says, as regard to films with DC copyright links, didn't Starman from 1984 have some acknowledgement to DC Comics? Rob will know. Ashamedly, Martin, I didn't. I meant to look it up because I actually own Starman digitally, and I meant to scroll through the credits and look, and I just completely forgot to do it, so I don't know. I will check back and report whether – I think that's true. I'm pretty sure that is true, but I have to verify it for myself.
Well, let's think about this for a second. So Karate Kid had to get recognized because he had a series, not just the character, but he had a series called Karate Kid. So there was a trademark comic book. Starman, I'm trying to remember. I don't know that he was obviously in first issue special.
He didn't have his own series. He didn't have his own headlined title. Yeah. He was in Adventure Comics and stuff, but no, he didn't. So
He may not be copyrighted in there. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know. If only someone had bothered to do the research ahead of time. All right, then we're from Edo Bosnar, who says, well, I have to say I'm absolutely flabbergasted that during your little digression about heroes who have a skylight for hair on their cowls or headpieces, Shag did not mention one of the most obvious examples, Firestorm. And he got so hot in that costume, his hair burst into flames. That is a fair dig, Mr. Bosnar. Absolutely. I should have mentioned Firestorm. I can't believe I didn't. Otherwise, great show. I agree that you have had some really gorgeous art in the entries this time, with Brainwave Jr. and Deathstroke being my personal favorites. Yeah, those were some great art, man. I'm curious to hear what you think about this time. So then we heard from Kevin from New Orleans, who says, regarding Alan Scott, when I was a kid, I didn't know about Earth 1 and Earth 2. I just thought Green Lantern and Flash had different costumes when they were younger in the All-Star Squadron. That is awesome. I love that kid logic.
Me too. I love it when kids do that. I used to do, you know, back when we were young and when we're not decrepit. But like, you just, kids just fill in the gaps.
Right?
They just do it. It's creative kids. Like, you just sit there and you go, oh, well, I guess it's that. And there you go.
I love that, Kevin. Thank you for sharing that.
There you go. By the way, I looked up the All-Star Squadron list and they did get two pages.
Okay. There we go.
Jerry Ordway. So there you go. But yeah, no, I think that's really great. And it's very elegant, right? It's not some convoluted thing. It's just, they're older. They were younger then and they changed costumes.
I mean, we wear different clothes than we did.
Yeah, makes total sense. Super Captain says, finally, I wanted to share a story from my local comic shop. I am buying my books a couple weeks ago when I heard another customer asking about the handbooks that Image is doing for their Ghost Machine titles. He mentioned that these handbooks will have variant covers that pay homage to Who's Who and also Ohatmu. I told him that there were some of my favorite comics as well, and then I asked if he had heard of the Who's Who podcast. He was interested, so we told him about your network. So hopefully you have a new listener. P.S. I come from roughly the same part of the country as Chris Franklin. I prefer the term hillbilly, or if you must, Appalachian American. Looking forward to May. Thank you, Super Captain. And thank you for promoting the show. It's amazing.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
Ward Hill Terry from the Stop Calling Me Frank band says, and you can see why I started with this comment, now to pick on Shag. As usual, when there is a character in Who's Who that appeared for 40-odd years in stories Shag has still never read, he's rather dismissive. However, when there's an entry that features a character from some of Shag's favorite books in the 90s, he becomes his own bad Who's Who entry. Oh, this guy was in that issue that I read, and then they did this with him, and then he happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. I can hear Rob's eyeballs rolling. Okay, let's pause the show here for a second. As much as I enjoy someone coming into the comments and ragging on Shag, Ward Hill, you're hearing things. Because my eyeballs are not rolling when Shag does that, because I actually find that to be very vital to the show, because, as I have said many, many times, my comics reading, while it technically continued long into the New 52, my fandom stops at, like, 1992. Like, even earlier than that, 1990. It just hits a heart. So Shag is way more conversant with that stuff after, and I find that out adds valuable balance to the show to be able to talk about something not quite so ancient. So my eyeballs are not rolling when Shag does that. I appreciate that he brings that knowledge, because I don't have it.
Oh, wow. That was incredibly you'll probably edit all this out because that was
far
too
I'm
nice.
Taking all that out, yeah.
Because, I mean, you do roll your eyes at me a lot. Maybe not in that particular
Not about
regard,
that, though.
Yeah.
Not about that is what I'm saying. So, okay. Yeah.
And all of this will result, by the way, in a late night text from Terry to me explaining what he was really thinking. So, anyway, because Terry's a great guy and loves me. And he tends to text me his comments rather than putting on the website. And I'm like, dude, put it on the website. This is great material. Why are you wasting it in a text? Anyway, all right. And by the way, Terry, yes, I do ramble on about the characters I love because it's my show. So there we go.
There you go.
Then we heard from Robert Markham, who says no mention of the planetary chance machine. Well, frankly, I had to Google that, Robert.
I don't even know what that is.
But I looked it up. Oh, when I looked it up, I'm like, oh, I know what that is. Okay, so first appears in Adventure Comics 319 from 1964. During the Silver Age of the Legion Superheroes, it was used by the team to randomly select which members would go on specific missions. So there we go. Yes, the planetary chance machine would have been nice to connect to the randomizer. You're right. That would have been a cute little connection. You're right. All right. They were from Chuck Coletta, from who's Dr. Pop Culture USA. He says, it's always a blast to see a News Who episode on the docket. Well, thank you, Chuck. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And he says, with a new Firestorm miniseries on the horizon, can we expect Shag to offer his comments? I also want to mention another commenter named Eric left a similar comment about the new Firestorm comic on the shelves. Guys, here's my position on it right now. I'm loving the series. I'm 3 issues in. I haven't read issue 4 yet. Absolutely stinking love what they're doing. It's dark. It's a little Vertigo-esque. If you're a hardcore Ronnie and Professor fan, you may not like it. I know some people don't because they're taking some creative liberties and they're dealing with that whole Doomsday Clock retcon. I'm loving it. I think it's a great, like, if you accept that the Doomsday Clock story happened and we can't change that, all right, it's done deal, then this is a great way to move forward. I think Jeff Lemire's a great modern comic writer. So I'm digging the Firestorm comic. Am I going to podcast about it? I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. Right now, it's a 9-issue series. We'll see where we go when it lands. Maybe I'll do something at the end. I don't know. But I am enjoying it. And so there you go. There's me talking about it on a podcast. How's that? Then we heard from Jeff Tischer, who always gives us this great whatever happened to listing of people. He says, another great episode. As I'm wrapping up listening to it, I can hear my wife singing along to the theme song in the other room. She knows that Who's Who Review listens are a big deal for me. That's awesome. That is
wow.
So, that's crazy.
Talk about what's that term? The monarch consort? Good job, Jeff.
Right. Welcome to the club, Jeff. Now, Jeff gives his usual listing of whatever happened to. And as I said, we're trying to keep the feedback a little shorter this time, folks. So I want you to go out to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, look up the last couple episodes, read the whatever happened to listings that Jeff has provided. They're absolutely fantastic. I'm going to read the one on Captain Compass because I really like this one. He says, Captain Compass's grandson, Martin, is part of a detective team consisting of him, Roy Raymond III, Sandra Bradley, who's the granddaughter of Slam, and Kathy Saunders, granddaughter of Speed Saunders and cousin of Hawkgirl. They have a podcast called All Things Impossible But True, and they're helping Bruce Wayne track down Jewish artwork that his grandfather was trying to safekeep from the Nazis during World War II. That sounds awesome. I love the idea of pairing up all these sort of Silver Age gumshoe detective characters or even Golden Age. I think that's a lot of cool ideas. That's super fun.
That's a great premise. I love that, right? Yeah. And tracking down the artwork reminds me of the movie The Monuments Men, which I think I'm the only human on the planet that liked that movie.
All right. Then he continues, because we had talked a little bit about how Who's Who is kind of gone now, and we have the DK encyclopedias instead, right? You know, you get those every few years, the DC encyclopedia, whatever. And he says that the DK encyclopedias are frustrating at best. They are sporadic in who they cover and how much coverage they give. For example, the fourth edition, the Golden Age Green Lantern has his own entry under Scott, Allen. Wildcat gets a quarter page with the most prominent image of the new 52 Earth 2 version, who never even went by the name Wildcat. He also says Jay Garrick is a footnote in the two-page Flash entry. And you can forget about continuity. They mix and match which versions of the characters are featured. For example, their Legionnaire entries from all versions mixed together. The original 5YL, the reboot, the 3-boot, the retro boot, the Bendis boot. And he says, so I would much rather they release a legitimate Who's Who series that can give actual entries about our beloved characters. Wow, that's really disappointing. You know, I bought the first couple DC encyclopedias, which were before, I guess, Flashpoint. So it was all post-crisis continuity. And they were decent. They were, you know, they're no Who's Who, but they were decent. But unfortunately, Jeff outlines here basically how they deteriorated after the original edition. He goes into specifics on that. So it's a shame. So, but I'm glad they're out there for newbies. But yeah, probably is more confusing than anything, really. Then we're from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He lists his top three favorite entries from last episode, or from this that particular episode, the Golden Age Green Lantern, Chlorophyll Kid, and Captain Storm. Good choices, Bucky. Good choices. They were from Alexander Osias, who from the Armchair Gamer blog. He says the Ron and Zeta Beam are related. He's sharing some information related to the Ron and the Zeta Beam. He says, in a superhero RPG campaign I ran, there was a guy who would show up irregularly and usually late. He wanted a rocket pack guy, so I told him he was related somehow to Adam Strange. And the Zeta Beam gave me a great reason to have him suddenly pop up in the middle of the action or non-action with the rest of the group and pass on the burden to explain what was going on to the rest of the players. That's a great idea. If you've got a player who shows up late, yeah, Zeta Beam's in. There you go, buddy. I love that idea.
Again, very clever. Yep. Hal says, Dr. Destiny's Materiopticon made the jump to the big screen where it was reimagined as the Dreamstone in the Wonder Woman 1984 movie. Hal, no such movie exists. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I just want to give you props for being able to say the name of that device that Dr. Destiny uses, because I certainly could not have pronounced that. So well done.
All right. Yeah, I don't know what he's talking about. There is no Wonder Woman 1984 movie. That's not a thing.
I still haven't watched it.
It's not you can't watch it. It's not a thing.
Maxwell Lord's in it. I need to watch it.
It doesn't exist. It's not a thing.
Does the quest for peace exist?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Interesting the lines we draw, sir.
It sure is. Captain
Earth 2 Aquaman didn't exist. There, I said it.
Captain, come on, let's bring the show back. Captain Entropy, my pal and
neighbor.
And neighbor now. We actually moved closer to him.
Yep.
Not for that reason, but we ended up doing that. Captain Entropy says, Mark Evanier said that the Kirby-based Glorious Godfrey on George Hamilton's portrayal of Billy Graham.
What?
Graham later rejected his early anti-Semitic opinions and increased his distance from political figures, but I can see his point at the time. I did not know that, but it makes total sense. I don't know when did George Hamilton play Billy Graham, but I don't know. That is exactly, because I know he played Evel Knievel. That's that's neither here nor there. Anyway, thank you for the information, Captain.
Wow. Fascinating.
All right. David S. Gutierrez, owner and operator of the Katana Banana Stand, the joke will never die, says, did Shag just compare Damn Yankees to the Traveling Wilburys? He does that all the time, David, and it just makes me want to pound my head on the desk.
I didn't realize it was such an irritant to so many people, so now I'm going to make sure I say it.
Yeah, I know. It's like waving a red flag, you know? Like, dope.
Then we heard from Jeremy Ciccone. So thank you so much for the pronunciation, Jeremy. I told you we slaughtered your name last time, and we did. So thank
Materiopticon.
Right. He says, thank you for another great show, guys. Sticking to my position of a one-track mind commenter, Chlorophyll Kid really got a chance to show off the effectiveness of his power during the unsurprisingly during the Great Darkness Saga, when he was stopping Daxamites by popping up redwoods in their face. Though I've always wondered what he could do with gut bacteria, or at least someone who just ate a salad. Wow, Jeremy, you went to a dark place with that salad story and gut bacteria. But the idea of throwing up redwoods in Daxamite's face is so stinking cool. I love that. That's awesome.
I mean, isn't lettuce super dangerous right now? So
We just put a timestamp on this episode, didn't we? Then we hear from Paul Wildenberger, who says, one thing that caught my attention during the feedback section. Shag, you mentioned you started collecting the Flash for the Firestorm backups, but didn't read the main title until years later. I, too, picked up my first issue of Flash, number 290, because I saw another cool character on the bottom of the cover, also in yellow and red. My 9-year-old brain was intrigued with why his head was on fire. While I definitely became a Firestorm fan, the Flash became my favorite hero of all time. I clicked the Flash comics from July 1980 until 1 year into the New 52, August 2012. Those 32 years went by really fast, pun intended. Well, now, Paul, in the feedback section, now you have to share the story of how you found out Barry Allen died. And if you had like that crane, what do you call it, Dolly Crane shot or whatever, where your world spins, where you're like, what?
I don't know. Not Dolly Crane, but something like that.
Yeah, okay. All right, fair enough. You're up next, buddy.
Gabu Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcast Network says, my introduction to Gray Morrow was Mark Hazard Merc, which would probably not have been his first choice, but I still dug it. Yeah, kind of like John Buscema. I got the feeling that Gray Morrow just had no time for superheroes, but wanted to keep working in comics. So, like, his artwork was always on, like, anything that wasn't superheroes, right? Because he drew Star Trek for a while, and then he did Merc, which was not superheroes. So, like, I think he was one of those guys who was like, I don't want to do these superhero stuff. What else you got? You know, that kind of stuff. Right. And unfortunately, all the war titles and the horror titles were going the way of the dodo. So he was like, Merc? What's that? All right, I'll do that. That's fine.
It's just so funny. When I think of the pantheon of the new universe, Gray Morrow is not a name that comes to mind. Like, I don't think I even knew he drew Mark Hazard Merc. Because I don't think I read past issue one of that series. So maybe they're worth checking out. I don't know. Then Frank goes on to say, Rudy Nebres is one of my all-time favorite cover artists, which is how I know that nothing else good came of the Archie Red Circle line. For all the times I wanted to buy issues with glorious Nebres covers and toilet paper interiors, I'm proud to own a couple of Nebres originals, which Shag openly admired the day we hung out with AJ Wright. But I won't excuse whatever was going on with Dr. Destiny's left hand here. All right. The man holds a grudge. Then we're from Steve Gibbons from the JLA Stories and Friends podcast. He says, great recommendation of the Alan Scott Green Lantern miniseries. Such a great work, and I got a chance to talk about it on my podcast, JLA Stories and Friends, with my friend Matt, who is not a comic book reader, but really appreciated the story. A particular note is the conversation Alan has with the Spectre, in which the Spectre tells Alan that he is a good man and has done nothing to be ashamed of. The audacity in having what is essentially DC's direct link to God come out and say that love is what comics are all about. Right up there with Captain America punching Hitler in the face. Very eloquent, Steve, and I'm glad you said it. Thank you. Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as Mr. and Mrs. Superman and Batman Nightcast and more. Chris says, first, Rob insults non-humanoid legionnaires. Then he calls me a redneck. Man, the guy's on a rampage. Well, I love Smokey and the Bandit. It's not my favorite movie. Superman the movie is. You'd think the guy who was my co-host for years about the show, about that film series, would remember that. I'm so hurt right now.
All right. I have two excuses. And so you can pick which one works for you. Get me out of this jam.
Nice. Good luck.
First of all, you know, when I tend to say favorite movie, I'm not necessarily thinking of in my mind as like number one, like above all else. Like I think of favorite, like my, like if you go to my Letterboxd account, there has four favorites. And so if someone says, what's your favorite movie? I would list the four. Right. Because I feel like that's, you know, when I was saying Smokey and the Bandit is his favorite movie, not like absolute number one on top of everything. It was just like, no, that's like one of his all-time most beloved movies. But okay. Secondly,
hey, but real quick, I'll defend you a little bit here in that, like, there's certain movies that you associate with other people too, whether it's their favorite
or
not.
Totally.
Like,
yeah.
When Smokey and the Bandit comes up, the two people that come to mind are Chris Franklin and me, right? Then when Ernest Goes to Camp, which is, by the way, another one of Rob's favorite movies,
which I think is Chris's favorite movie.
When you think of Ernest, you think of Chris because he's always got a good joke about these are Ernest movies. So there you go.
Yeah. Okay, then the other excuse is, you know how many podcasts I've done in my life, Chris? It's hard to, I'm getting older, and it is hard to remember what's all been said. I mean, we are now getting to the age, and as Shag just pointed out at the top of the show, we've now been doing this for 15 years.
To be fair, I've been doing this for 20. I've only been with you for 15.
All right, I've been doing this for, we've been doing this, intensive podcasting together for 15 years. Every so often I'll go and I have to play an old episode for some reason. I'm looking for a clip of something. And like, I don't even remember who this person is who's talking. Right. I know that's me, but I'm like, did I say that? I don't remember. So you can't, give me a break. We haven't done this. We did the original Superman movie podcast like 8 years ago, 9 years ago at this point. So I'm sorry. I forgot these things, but you know, okay.
I think what he's saying, Chris, is at this point, you're lucky he even remembers your name. So
thank God we have the Firewater thread to remind me every day.
All right. Then we heard from Paul Keehan, also from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has
Paul Keehan, who's that?
Oh, good Lord. He shows his TC special cast and part of The Sandman Slept Here, which apparently Rob's never listened to either show. Anyway, he says, beep, boop, the randomizer was the best host today. Just kidding. Maybe. Wow. Okay. Wow. That's a dig against both of us. So
it's going to come up in your performance review.
Right.
Paul.
I sign the paychecks every 2 months or every 2 weeks. So I'm remembering this, Paul. All right. Nate the Great says that Superboy, because we talked about a team up between Superboy and Batman, which was kind of throwing us. That Superboy Batman team up was in Brave and the Bold number 192. Always a treat when Jim Aparo got to draw a Superman family member. There we go.
That's absolutely true. Tim Price from the Outcasters and Avengers Under Siege podcast, which I guessed it on not that long ago, says the first story I read with Dr. Destiny must have been a JLA Treasury, as I remember that Dr. Destiny created the Materiopticon, I said it again, in his dreams while in prison, and he was able to use it to create things in the real world like chocolate candies. It's a low-level villain. And then other stuff happened because I don't remember anymore. And yet I can spell Materiopticon from memory. Insert therapy joke here. Isn't that amazing, right? The stuff that gets lodged in our brains that right. you can remember yep. that, and yet, you know, things from a year ago, you're like, wait, what? Who's that? So,
or you can't even remember the name of your friend, Chris Franklin.
Yeah.
All right, John Stibe, who says, a very enjoyable episode of The Review, as the kids are calling it now, from everyone involved. It's funny how I've changed as a reader. When I bought the original Who's Who, I would have skimmed and even skipped the entries for Captain Compass and Captain Storm as similar characters, since I was strictly a superhero kid. I still am, but I found myself drawn to those untapped by me genres at DC, and I didn't read like non-costume adventure or war or Western comics. Yeah, John, I'm the same way. When I'm going through the Who's Who and I come across an entry like today with Unknown Soldier, it just takes me back, like, wow, or take a back. And I'm like, wow, this is a genre that I really missed out on. So once in a while, the Westerns, I have not really been wowed. I mean, maybe Jonah Hex, but most Westerns I go back in like the 50s. I'm like, this is a struggle to get through. But like the more modern Western comics are great. The war comics are great on all the way back. Honestly, they're always fantastic. So good stuff. Yeah, I'm glad that it sort of piques your interest as well. Then we're from Lizanne Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. She comments on IQ, which was a character we picked on quite a bit. She says, he looks like a Mr. Steed fanboy. I believe she means like Steed and Peele from the Avengers. He looks like a Mr. Steed fanboy without the cool hat and a yellow ascot. Jeez, what is he rating Hef's wardrobe? Also, the outfit is fine till the yellow ascot. Blue and the purple are cool, but yellow? Just no. Next. I think we felt about the same.
Brett Young from this very network, I think, hosts the Fantastic Four podcast.
You've heard.
He says, great show, guys. Congratulations, Shag. This episode has, by far, your worst take by comparing damn Yankees favorably to the Traveling Wilburys. Sure, one group has a folk legend and a Beatle, but the other group has the dope who did that scratch fever. This was the Red Bee of music opinions.
Oh, my gosh. I was fine with the criticism till he brought in Red B. I mean, that's overstepping the line. This is like the third time Brett has overstepped the line boundaries.
Brett brings violence sometimes, and I love it.
I mean, Rob had to apologize for Brett in the thread the other day. It was so bad. Okay, look, the guy, a couple quick things. So, first of all, damn Yankees, a guy from Styx, a guy from Night Ranger. That's awesome. The guy who did Cat Scratch Fever, the only thing I will say about that complimentary is – he actually used to buy bows and arrows from my grandmother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. Well, my grandmother owned a sporting goods shop in Michigan, and he knew her, like, by name. He knew Joe, my grandma, and he would buy bows and arrows from her. So, I mean, there's a piece of my life that's connected in a weird way to that. So, anyway, Brett goes on rambling. He says, I really like the understated cool of the Captain Compass entry. Little known fact, Captain Compass was on my Justice League draft board. It was between him and Batlash. Well, once again, Brett, you made the wrong choice. Captain Compass would have been a better choice. Then Brett goes on to ramble, I could never get into the Vigilante. I like his absolute psychotic portrayal in Peacemaker, but his comic outfit always made... But his comic outfit always made him look like he should be on the slopes in a James Bond winter action scene. Oh my God, he is dead right. It does look totally like a Roger Moore outfit that some bad guy would have worn. Oh, that's great.
I'm here for the For Your Eyes Only references. Noah Tarnow from the Big Quiz thing and the I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Pod, got off my lung cast, says, so you're never going to do the impact issues? No. No, we're not, Noah.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. We have had a plan for, God, like 6 or 7 years now. Actually, since we started the Loose Leaf in 2018. So what's that? That's too much math. 8 years. We've had a plan. We know exactly how we're going to cover it. It's just a question of when. So there we go. He goes on to say, good question about the most popular DC, new DC characters of the past 50 years. Because we did pose that question. Like, we're debating who was the most popular DC character from the last 50 years. I had stipulated that Deathstroke was one of them. So he agrees Harley Quinn's number one. But I'm not sure Deathstroke's number two. Cyborg has to be up there. Also, Bane, which I hadn't given thought to. You make a good point there, Noah. Bane is pretty popular in the public consciousness. And then he says, in a few more years, it could be Michael Holt version of Mr. Terrific. Man, I hope so. I really do. I hope that that what James Gunn started in the Superman film really continues to catch momentum. That would be awesome because that Michael Holt is such a great character. All right, so that is the comments from our Who's Who review number 12. Now we're going to move on to the comments from the Chuck Patton interview from May. First up is Ryan Daly, who Rob's never heard of, from the Firewater Podcast Network.
First I've heard of this guy.
Oh, well played. He has Cheers Cast and Batman Nightcast, and he says, I've never listened to this podcast before, but I hope every episode is this good. So much fun to listen to, guys. Great interview. Absolutely loving hearing Chuck's stories and insights and occasional grievances with these Who's Who entries. Yeah, I mean, Chuck was so honest. I mean, I don't want to say raw, but in a way he was. I mean, he didn't hold back. He was completely unfiltered, was very honest about his opinions, and it was awesome. What a great interview, man.
Oh, it was an enormous honor. Steve Givens says, Rob Kelly, making the world a better place one comic book creator at a time. Thank you, Steve.
Well, that's a reference, obviously, yes, to you reconnecting Chuck's love to the comics and in a bizarre way, kind of helping him find his fiance. So
that's crazy.
So we heard from John Dredge, who simply said, really love this. So thanks, John. Glad you liked
it. John. And Oboznar says, oh, wow. I always love episodes that feature discussions with creators. And this one did not disappoint. Loved listening to Patton's comments on the various entries he drew and the details behind them. My personal favorites, by the way, are Aquaman, Mon-El, and Phobia, but they're all really good. Otherwise, though, I would have loved seeing his work on a revived Star Hunters or something he mentioned as an aside, Stalker series. Great job, Rob and Chag. Edo, in case you haven't listened, go check out a recent episode of the DC Special Cast where they talk about the first appearance of the Star Hunters in detail.
And who's that hosted by?
Who's in the thread? What is that? I don't know. It's some guy that makes fun of me about me not getting treasuries on time. Michelle Fee.
Which never stops being funny, by the
which
way.
Which never stops being funny. Oh, I had a meltdown when I couldn't get that one book. Michelle Fife. See, I was being honest with you guys, and it's thrown back in my face. Thanks so much.
How do you think I feel every day with Brett? Every single day, Brett goes for my jugular. I don't know what it is.
Shag, why did we let other people into the group? It was better when it was just you and I, wasn't it?
I'm not going to answer that. But I did not vote for Brett. I think I voted against him, actually. I think I still can.
It was like that issue of Flash when the Justice League voted whether he's the murderer or not. Like, this is an anonymous vote. Yeah, Brett, it was unanimous, sure. Michelle Fife, creator and writer artist of Copra, says, I'm struck by the mixture of celebration and frustration in this great interview. Youthful enthusiasm tempered by office politics, being mentored by the best, but still running into editorial snags. Everyone's trajectory is different, but the general beats seem time honored. You break into the industry with your dreams and ambitions intact, but then you have to deal with a dicey playing field. The work speaks for itself, though, so I'm glad he knows how fond we all are of his efforts in that heartbreaking period. Overall, great talk. Jack and Rob, your love and respect of this stuff shines through. Super glad Chuck Patton took us down at memory lane. Thank you, Michelle. You're a great artist as well, and I knew that, you know, of course, you'd be able to particularly relate to some of the frustrations that Chuck Patton had. Like I said, it was just an honor to talk to him.
Yeah, and Michelle actually got the chance to interact with Chuck on Facebook about the interview.
Some of the
comment threads, and then I got a chance to see Michelle at a Heroes Con and chat with him a little bit, and just he's such a great guy. So yeah, it was just awesome. Yeah. All right, they were from George Henry, who says, was really glad to hear from Chuck and how open he was. His work was beautiful and truly a loss for the fans. It really epitomized the best of DC's art look in the 1980s. Unfortunately, everyone seemed to get outshined by the legend of George Perez. Chuck is like Lou Gehrig of the 1927 Yankees. The game where Babe Ruth called a shot, Gehrig hit back homers like it was nothing. Chuck's work meant a lot to me then and now. Well, thank you, George. Then we heard from Tim Price again. It says, I had the pleasure of interviewing Chuck a couple years ago, and he was just as delightful as he is here. It was just a joy to hear him discuss these pages firsthand. Congrats, guys. Heard from Greg F, who says, great episode, guys. Liked it so much, I listened twice. Wow. Thanks, Greg. I'm honored. Then Doug Zawisha says, while George Perez was the first JLA artist for me, because my first comic purchase was JLA 192, Chuck Patton drew more of my JLA. Grateful for his work and the fun chat on the show.
All right. Paul Ken from some podcast network says, awesome episode, guys. Just a delight to hear Chuck talk about his art, and especially interesting to hear his thoughts about different inkers. Really a top-notch show.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff you brought about inkers was really fascinating, too, now that you mention it, yeah. Yep. Movie Matt Soroyce, again, says, gentlemen, thunderous applause are inadequate. This was a fabulous episode. Chuck Patton is so incredibly deserving of this honor. When I learned that Mr. Patton had left comics under bitter circumstances, I was appalled. It has bothered me deeply for many years. He is one of my all-time favorite artists. Justice League of America 224 is one of my single favorite comic book issues. And we're here to hoist Mr. Patton up on our shoulders and thank him for some amazing comic art. I would like to congratulate Robin Shagg for letting Mr. Patton know he has fans who loved his contributions to the comic book history and helped him reconcile with that. It was an amazing experience. Well, thank you, Matt. But really, it's down to Chuck. It was all him, man. He was great. If we played some small role in helping him fall in love with the work again, that's awesome. That's great. Yep.
Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, comic book commentary, and the Legion of Superbloggers says, really love this. Love Chuck remembering his thoughts about so many of these, his thoughts on who inked him best, and most importantly, the ones he asked big for because he loved them. Multi-Man is the equivalent of Dr. Doom. Only a true fan would say that. Love that the most. I can't wait for the DC, Multi-Man Day movie that's coming in a couple of years.
Multi-Day.
He says, I'm no artist, but I can see myself asking to be part of Hiathus, Stalker, and Dr. Zinzin.
It's like a bingo card with that guy. I mean, really, we could make up Dr. Ange bingo cards and ding, 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 bingo. surprised he didn't mention Nemesis Kid in that. Martin Gray.
Or the Manhawks.
Right. So it was a wonderful episode. So Martin Gray says, wonderful episode. Cheers, Chuck. It was fantastic to hear about the process of the Who's Who entries. I wonder if Chuck is underselling the strength of his line work, because the distinctive Robert Caponella and Frank Giacoya finishes apart, everything looks very similar in terms of clean lines and sharpness. All right. I mean, Chuck's line work is flawless. I mean, if you follow him on Facebook, you'll see lots of his pencil work now, too. The guy's art is amazing. So I hear what you're saying, Martin. Then Liz Ann Oswald chimes in and says, I did not know who this man was, but I've been a fan of his work for years. Just didn't know who he was. But yeah, a lot of these entries are ones I tried to learn to draw from as a kid or marveled at how well they were drawn. Oh, well, thank you for sharing that, Liz. Appreciate that. Then Nate the Great says, good interview with Chuck Patton. He does seem underappreciated, probably because the Detroit League was not a humongous hit. But you know what? It still means a lot to me because Aquaman got to lead it and he was always one of my favorites.
Yeah. Super Captain says, thank you for this conversation with Chuck Patton. I will forever be grateful that he helped introduce me to some of my favorite lesser-known DC characters through his Who's Who entries for Bawana Beast and Kongorilla and Kongorilla's appearance in the second issue of DC Challenge. I wish we could have seen more of his work in comics, but it sounds like he's had a great career in animation. And I absolutely love the cadre, especially their look, and would love to see them return in some way at DC.
Yeah. Noah Tarno chimes in and says, great job. Patton was probably the first JLA artist I was aware of, so his work will always have a special place for me. And then he asks a question, which multiple people asked, and saying, where and when was it established that Simon, meaning the creepy open brain guy from Titans, or from the Fearsome Five, when was it established that Simon was gay? Yeah, because Chuck just kind of said that like as if everyone knew that. I didn't realize Simon was gay. I mean, I guess it's and I just admitted not reading the Wolfman Press Titans too. So maybe it's in there. But several people were like, "Simon's gay." I had no idea. So.
All right, Chris Franklin, host of the Smokey and the Bandit Minute podcast, says, "Great discussion, gents. Chuck was a delight. Even as a kid, I was wowed by his art and the much needed shot in the arm he gave the JLA. I was really sad to see him leave the book, and it was only his art that was really keeping me interested in the way the Detroit era storyline was playing out. Like others have said, his insight into the production and selection process of Who's Who was fascinating. I can't wait to see the Dale Gunn piece he's creating for our favorite nephew. another feather in the cap of Who's Who. This is one of the best episodes of an already great series that obviously means a lot to the folks in and around the network. Thank you, sir.
Oliver says, such a pity that two of my favorite Chuck Patton characters, the supervillain Maximus Rex and Hellraiser, only appeared once, and so they don't qualify for Who's Who entries. If money was no object, this diabolical pair is who I'd commission for Mr. Patton. All right.
Can I, before we move on to that, can I mention something about Maximus Rex?
Is this from the B storyline from JLA?
Yeah, this is the B. This is the B storyline. This is very unusual, and I meant to mention this. We were talking about Jerry Conway. Of course, we lost Jerry Conway just a couple of months ago. That storyline, the three issues of JLA, right? That's a real turning point because it's pretty bloody. Like the JLA have wandered into a horror movie. And I really liked those. I wouldn't have wanted the JLA book to be like that permanently, but it was a nice kind of change of pace. And I was fortunate enough to interview Jerry Conway a couple of times back when I had blogs. And multiple times I directly asked him about those three issues, and he literally never gave me an answer. Literally act like I didn't say anything. And I always wondered if he was retroactively ashamed of them or something. Hmm. Because he literally, he just skipped over the question.
That's so strange.
Right? And I didn't want to press. You know, after I noticed it the second or third time, I was like, he's okay. He must not want to talk about these. And I have to wonder if they were ever because they did appear in three issues of Justice League of America. Right. I have to wonder if they had any chance of appearing maybe as a group in Who's Who. Not that they would go to Conway for his decision, but I almost wonder if Jerry Conway was like, oh, God, I hate those characters. Don't ever bring them up again, you know, or something like that. They've just been forgotten because I think they deserved a Who's Who listing, at least as a group. It's just a weird thing with Jerry. I don't think he liked those characters.
Since we're getting purely speculative here, that was the era where he was struggling, or soon after, where he was going through an ugly divorce. So, but prior to that, his wife had contributed some story plot ideas to some of the issues. Every once in a while you'd see. So I wonder if it could have been that. Could have been maybe she gave some input on that one, and then things aren't going well, so he didn't want to talk about it. I don't know. I interviewed Jerry seven times, and I never had him dodge a question. So clearly that's something. Huh, interesting.
Oh, yeah. He was always a great interview and gave wonderfully warm, expansive answers. And then there was just this weird blot where it was silence. I'm like,
yep.
Huh. Okay. All right. I'll stop asking him about this.
Yeah. To be fair, there was also once in a blue moon where he'd be like, look, guys, that was 40 years ago. Seriously, you're going to get that kind of level of minutia. Sorry, Jerry.
Well, I mean, we both were guilty of that. So.
Right. All right, so then Jeff Tischer again chimes in. He says, what an amazing episode. Justice League of America 241 to 243 were some of my very first comics that were mine. At that age, I didn't quite grasp the concept of artists on covers versus interiors, so I couldn't understand why the characters looked so different inside. I have three indelible images of Aquaman that are the mold by which all others are judged. The package art of the superpowers figure, the Who's Who entry, and the cover of Justice League of America 242. All right. Then Jeff gives us the next Whatever Happened To. I mentioned to you earlier, he does these great Whatever Happened To entries. So I just picked one to highlight this time. Congo Bill and Congorilla, because Chuck really went on and on talking about them, right? So what Jeff reveals to us here, it's been revealed that Congo Bill and Congorilla is the warden of Monster Rock, an island where the Justice League sends many of their unintentionally dangerous creatures they encounter. There they can live in relative peace. It was also revealed in the new history of the DC Universe that after the JSA retired, Bill was part of the short-lived Justice Alliance led by Captain Comet with Prince Ramon, Automan, and Tiger Man. So that's awesome. First of all, the idea, I guess I wasn't aware of this Monster Rock, which sounds kind of like Dinosaur Island, but anyway, where the Justice League sends their unintentionally dangerous creatures to live in peace. I love that, right?
That's a great idea. I love it.
Don't euthanize the Shaggy Man. Send him off to an island. That's great. The Justice Alliance, it was this throwaway thing in the new history of the DC Universe. It's got to be some breadcrumb that somebody says they want to develop as a story. But basically saying there's a team between the Justice Society and the Justice League called Justice Alliance with all these great characters from the 50s. Fun stuff. All right. Then we hear from Diablo Frank again, who says, I've said in the past, but that Chuck Patton has a wonderfully licensing-friendly take on DC heroes that recalls the JLGL style guide and John Romita's 1970s work, with his Aquaman being the prime example. No disrespect to Alex Savage fans out there, but imagine Chuck Patton doing all the card merchandise art for the Superpowers collection. Oh, could you imagine?
That would have been great stuff, yeah.
Really would have. Then he says, I'm really happy with all the Mike Sikowski love expressed in this episode. Most of my favorite Silver Age comics involve Sikowski. Diana Prince, Wonder Woman, Thunder Agents, etc. And if you only know Sikowski from his wonky JLA stuff, you're doing him and yourself a disservice for sleeping on his various showcase features, especially Manhunter 2070. Interesting. I really don't know Sikowski at all outside of the JLA stuff. So those are interesting recommendations. Thanks, Frank. Then he says, I'm 2 hours into a second listen of this episode as I draft these comments. Chuck Patton was among DC's top artists of the 1980s, and instead of fostering that talent, he was done dirty. He deserved this showcase and a lot of more comics with his name in the credits. Absolutely agree, Frank, and that's a beautiful way to wrap up the comments. Really nice. All right, folks, now it is time to thank everyone who shared our show in their social media timeline. So this is Facebook and Blue Sky and theoretically Instagram, but Instagram has become extremely difficult to capture the shares and reshares. But I know this sounds like a long list of names. It sounds like we're reading a really bizarre phone book, but we always want to recognize the people who help promote the show. So each and one of these folks are very important to us in the Who's Who family. And again, apologies, Facebook and both Instagram, again, they've changed their whole the way they work now. And so finding the shares and reshares are very challenging. So I've missed anyone. I sincerely apologize. So the first person that we should mention who shared our show was Mr. Chuck Patton himself. That's awesome. So our thanks go out to these other folks. You could be on this list, by the way. Just share or retweet or reshare or whatever the heck it's called on the various social media platforms. So our thanks go out to Al the Comics Guy, Alan Boyce Jr., Bailey Planet, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Bill Beer and his account for The Bat Pod, Billy Delicious and his account for A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Black Vulcan 69, Blue Kryptonite, Brian Schufo, Brian Morris, Brown Park Bandit 92, Chris Franklin, Clinton Robinson and his accounts for Coffee and Comics and Fan Films Fridays podcast, Collateral Cinema, Comic Foil, Craig Fernandez, Craig McD, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dave's Comics Heroes blog, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Black Label, DC in the 80s, Deco Parsnip, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank and his Rolled Spine podcast account, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Duke City Comic Con, Ed Moore Jr., Fantastic Comic Fan, James Young, Jeff Grant, Jeff Weinberg, John Steib, Justice Trek, Kara Lovett, Keen Comics,
Peachy Baker, Kirk Spencer, Know It Some, Liz Ann Oswalt, Longbox Review, Luciano Varioletti, Mark Baker Wright, Michelle Fife, Mike Jameson and his three accounts. Was he me? Pop Culture Basement Podcast Network, Sleazebag Cinema, and This Lightsaber Kills Fascists. Mike Laval, Mike Thomas, Monitor Earth Prime, Movie Matt Cerise, Paul Ken, Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman Podcast, Prayer of Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Qatari Ninja Warrior, Raymond Savage, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Ryan Daly and Batman Nightcast, S. Matthew Stolt, Salty the Aqua Dog, Sam Lowe, Scott X, Sean Gilmore, Silverman on Security, Siskoid, Steve Givens, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Terrificon, That Giffen Show, Tim Price and Outcasters Under Siege and Avengers Podcast, Uncle Bruno's Customs, Vincent Loves Comics, and Wilfredo Rosario.
Oof, man. Thank you so much, folks, for supporting the show. Again, go on social media, Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, reshare the show, and we will do our best to get your mention on the next episode, which will be in November. By the way, Rob, you don't know this yet, but in November, we are going to be announcing the winner of the Legion of Doom draft t-shirt drawing. So basically, you listen to the Legion of Doom episode that comes out later this week. You leave a comment on our website, specifically on our website, and within the first 4 weeks after it's released, and we will do a random drawing from one of those people who left a comment that voted on their favorite team, and they will be awarded a Fire and Water Podcast Network shirt. And we will contact them directly, but we'll announce the winner here on the next Who's Who as well.
Oh, very exciting. I did not know that. Okay.
Yep. I don't tell you everything. Got to keep this relationship fresh somehow. Well, Rom, that's going to do it. We'll have another 13 entries in November. I'm really looking forward to it. This has been a lot of fun. I always love doing these things. They reinvigorate my love of life, I guess is the best way to put it. Work just crushes your soul, and this brings joy.
That's true enough. Yeah, no, this is always a blast. Looking at some of this really nice artwork again, it's just so, it's like, oh, it's just so nice to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's going to do it, folks. Thank you again. Leave your comments on our website. And until next time,
who's next? Next.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of a DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etric and Arisia and Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Oh, man. We forgot Slipknot.
Woo! Woozy, turn that thing off!
I'm trying.